You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege this week to welcome to Talk Nation Radio George Lakey, recently retired from Swarthmore College, where he was Eugene M. Lang Visiting Professor for Issues in Social Change, and where he managed the Global Nonviolent Action Database Research Project. George Lakey's first arrest was for a civil rights sit-in. He has served as an unarmed bodyguard for human rights defenders in Sri Lanka. He has led over 1,500 social change workshops on five continents and founded, and for 15 years directed, Training for Change. In 2010, George Lakey was named Peace Educator of the Year and published his authoritative text on adult education called Facilitating Group Learning. But today we will discuss George Lakey's ninth book, Viking Economics: How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. George Lakey, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
I'm so pleased to be here.
Very glad to have you. Loved the book. If someone today were to win the birth lottery and get born in the best place with the greatest health and wealth and happiness and life expectancy and security and so forth, where would that be?
That would definitely be the Scandinavian countries. And it's because, and the reason I know that is because in multiple indices that measure economic well-being, it's the Nordic countries that come out on top. They play musical chairs on the top. One year it's Denmark that's that wins the happiness lottery, and then yeah, next year it's Iceland and so on.
Which means you hate America, I guess.
No, not at all. I had a great job in Norway when I lived there long ago, and I was studying there and so on, and could very easily have settled down there. I had family there. I'd married into the country. And chose to come back to this country because I feel my destiny is here. I'm kind of a patriot, really.
I hope not. God, I was joking. Let's do away with patriotism if at all possible.
What do you call that identity thing that makes you feel like you have a people? It's that thing that I've got.
I call it Charlottesvilleanism or maybe Virginianism. I don't know about why it always has to be at the level of militaries. But in all seriousness, the United States could do with some ability to learn from others, and here are some countries doing some things right. What are they doing differently? Why is it better there?
Well, the fundamental thing is an economic approach that puts people first rather than something called the market first.
Yeah.
And so they're constantly asking themselves, how do we need to tweak this model so that it'll come through more effectively for the people? For one thing, for the producers, that is, say, the workers. They're constantly asking, what is it how can we redesign jobs to make them more attractive? How can we make sure that workers can move from one job to the other? Because they don't believe that a square peg in a round hole is a good idea, right? So somebody might be in a job for one reason or another that doesn't suit them at all. Or maybe they've been doing great in a job for the last 20 years and they get bored with it and they're ready for something new. So the Nordic countries offer free higher education, free training, free apprentice programs, whatever it takes to enable a person to get a new start on their productive life when they're 45 or 50 or whatever it is they want to try something new. So it's a very people-oriented way of doing an economy.
Yeah, and it seems that labor and workers' interests in these countries are not just focused on whoever, that tiny fraction in the United States, whoever happens to be in their union, but on everybody. And that creates very different results, right?
That's right. That's right. The common good is a phrase that you hear a lot over there. What is it that looks out for the common good? On the other hand, they do love to create associations that look after the interests of particular groups. For example, farmers, family farmers, have played a very important role in Norway's development. They don't like agribusiness, and so they really emphasize and safeguard the right of and the role of family farmers in producing food. So practically all the dairy, for example, even in that very, and I'm thinking now of Norway, which has only 3% of its land even available for agriculture, that land is jealously guarded. And so, you know, real estate interests and so on, can't, developers can't move in and take that farmland away. And so the farmers, and the farmers are subsidized because it is so far in the north and the growing season is short. So they need to be subsidized by the nation as a whole in order to be able to keep going well. But on the other hand, they fight for themselves. You know, they say, hey, look, what would we do for food security if the farmers were gone? And that's us, so you have to treat us well. And on the other hand, since they are a minority, the majority of the country agrees with them and does favor them. And that's one reason why Norway refused to join the European Union, because the European Union as a whole is not friendly to family farmers.
But it seems that in creating systems of support for everybody, for job counseling and training for anyone, there ceases to be any sort of stigma attached to it. Whereas in the United States, in, you know, providing government handouts to whoever is in the worst shape, and little of those as it is, there's a stigma attached. And then the interests in supporting those programs are primarily the interests of the very poor who have the least power to maintain or improve them. Somehow having structures of support for everybody that then everybody takes an interest in including everybody's interests in farmers, works better. But the United States doesn't seem to get that.
No. Well, I would say, based on recent polls, and I have a bunch of those polls in my book, a majority of Americans would be delighted, actually, to use the Nordic model as our economic model. But the holdouts would be the 1%. So-called 1%, you know, the economic elite, because their interests are not served by the Nordic model. In fact, the Norwegian and Swedish and Danish 1% resisted like crazy the imposition of the Nordic model. They called out the troops against the farmers and workers who were the majority of the country and who were saying, you know, with middle class allies, of course, saying we need a new model. We hate how much poverty there is. We hate that we don't have much individual freedom here. We don't have democracy, and we want a new day. And the economic elite fought back and even called out the troops and killed workers and so on who were demonstrating in order to defend their privilege. And that's not really surprising, because people will defend privilege very often. And that's certainly been the case historically in our country, too, that the 1% defends its privilege. So they didn't wait around until they could convince their 1% that a new day needed to come. They fought hard, nonviolently. Created huge nonviolent movements in the streets and in the workplace and on the farms to demand, and then push the 1% out, actually, so they could no longer dominate the country. And then that's what opened the space so they could invent this new thing called what the economists call the Nordic model.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even in recent years, the far greater and more militant nonviolent activism in these countries that already had it better in some ways than what we have in the United States. So even in the 80s, pushing back against Thatcherism, you had aggressive campaigns, and the people in Denmark surrounding the legislature, and even in Iceland in post-2008, people banging pots and pans and surrounding the legislature. Are these lessons for people in the United States?
I think so. I mean, in Iceland, in the reference you made to their rebellion against the government that had let the bankers run wild. Well, we had let our bankers run wild too, right? But in Iceland, they rose up and they put 3% of their population on the streets. in that nonviolent revolutionary upsurge and brought down the government. And sometimes I like to think, what would it be like if 3% of Americans got out of the streets and demanded? We would get such a lot of change if 3% of us came forward, because that is, what is it, 10 million people? It's an enormous lot of people. And if we were sharp and clear and used nonviolent tactics as the Icelanders did, we would have a fine country as well.
Could we do that all as close to our homes as Icelanders? Because Washington, D.C. is thousands of miles from most people.
Well, Dr. King taught us a lesson about that, because he was getting a logjam resistance to civil rights laws in Washington. So he went to Birmingham, Alabama, and dislocated an industrial city. It was at that time. U.S. Steel was huge down there. And created such an uproar that then Washington had to act. And then the movie Selma recently around, right,
sure,
shows again making a tremendous uproar distant from Washington that forced, in that case, LBJ, to act when he really didn't want to act. So it is possible to really put the pressure on the national establishment, whether it's inside Oslo or inside Stockholm or inside Washington, D.C., by going to another part of the country and raising a rumpus.
But if what we're after would work best at the national level, are there still ways to get it at the state and local level? I mean, can we get decent universal single-payer health care and lower working hours and guaranteed retirement pay and family leave and real public transportation and sustainable infrastructure and so forth? Can we get these things at the local and state levels and take them national?
I don't see how to do that, because what made the difference over there was being able to push the 1% out of dominance of the political system. And the 1% in the United States isn't really organized locally, right? I mean, those are families that, Wall Street's in New York, and those super rich families, aren't, can't really be tied down by its state capital. If the state said, well, you live in our state, it'd be very easy for them to move to another state. They probably already have three homes in three different states. So it's way, way easier to gang up the 1% if one does it nationally than if one tries to do it state by state.
But we can act locally and have a national impact?
Yes, we can. By creating big disturbance. We can also act locally by creating laboratories, experiments that show the superiority of alternative institutions. For example, as part of my book tour, I recently went through Vermont during New Economy Week and discovered a number of very promising local experiments, co-ops, and including producer co-ops that are more efficient than some of the capitalist enterprises, and so on. So we can, and that, by the way, was also the Scandinavian route to power. They built a tremendous infrastructure of cooperative institutions in Sweden. Sweden was the leader, and Denmark on the agricultural front was the leader in the co-op field, and then Norway tagged along, and Iceland. And it was just fascinating, actually, to look historically at how much local activism through cooperatives and developing that structure then gave people a power base, so that then when they did their nonviolent direct action, they weren't coming from nowhere, or just from their own homes or
right,
factories, but also they were coming from a place of confidence. They knew that capitalism is not the only way to do an economy, and then actually it's an inferior way to other ways.
We're speaking with George Lakey, and the book is Viking Economics. And one thing I love about the book is not just that you show that nonviolent action and organizing had this impact, that things didn't just happen by chance, but you also refute very well some of the common myths put out in the U.S. about Scandinavia. Oh, well, they're just smaller. Or, well, this sort of racist idea, well, they're homogenous. Or Norway has oil, as if the United States doesn't. doesn't have oil. Can you go through some of your responses to these claims?
Sure. Yeah, Norway has, of course, a huge bucket of oil and gas, but Sweden has zero, and Denmark has a tiny bit, and Iceland has zero. But they all share the Nordic system, and they all have similar outcomes. So and actually Norway went through its major transition without any oil or gas. So the oil and gas is kind of the icing on top of their particular Norwegian cake, but the others don't even have that. I'll tell you, David, I really learned a lesson about this question of scale and homogeneity, because I was skeptical about that myself. You know, I was doing serious research back and forth, supported by Swarthmore College, to learn more about these Scandinavians. And on my way into Research Institute, into the conference room, there on the wall, the general wall in the hall, was a framed picture of a bunch of Chinese looking into the camera alongside the researchers I was about to interview. And I said, whoa, those folks look like Chinese. And they said, yeah, they were a delegation of economists and policymakers who were sent from Beijing by the People's Republic in order to learn from Norway. And my jaw dropped open, frankly. Because China makes the United States look like a small country, and it also and China is so heterogeneous. I mean, tons of people can't even talk common language. It's phenomenal to think of China being able to learn something from tiny Norway. So I said that, and they said we wondered the same thing, frankly. And as soon as we sat this Chinese delegation down in our conference room, we said, "Why are you here?" And so they had a moment when the Chinese explained that when it comes to the economy, there's some things that don't scale up that do need to be, you know, done in a small way, and other things that scale up fine. And there's some things where cultural difference makes quite a difference, but there are other things where culture doesn't matter, and you can just extrapolate from one place to another. So I really got to thinking about that, and I thought about Social Security, which is a system that works fine in tiny Iceland with 320,000 people, but it works fine in the United States. In fact, it works so fine that the 1% wants to expropriate it and put it on Wall Street.
That's right.
Instead of letting us keep it. And Medicare, which works really fine in the U.S., the studies show that people who are on Medicare much prefer it to the private health plan that they had before. And Medicare works in Scandinavia. Medicare works here in this huge country. So the Chinese were interested in Medicare. So, yeah, so some things can scale up and some things can't. So if we chose to get serious about the Nordic model and started developing the political heft so we could impose it here, or not impose it but adapt it for our country, then we'll want to pay attention to scale, of course. And a lot of things will probably scale up just fine,
yeah.
And some things might not.
And a lot of things look like they obviously almost certainly would work just fine, but haven't been tried. And reading your book, I read about, you know, I think it was in Sweden experimenting with shorter working hours to see if that actually increases productivity and all these sorts of experimentation. And one of these four countries learning something and the other three benefiting the way people imagine the United States states as laboratories of experimentation. But the expectation there in Scandinavia is that whatever's learned will be acted on.
That's
Whereas
right.
In the United States, my expectation is that, you know, if they learn that prisons actually increase crime, the result will be, well, is there more profit? Is there more corruption in building more prisons? Well, then we'll just build more prisons. There's no expectation that results will follow knowledge in the United States. So there's this level of corruption that has to be overcome before we can even, you know, benefit. I mean, we all know that it's more effective to provide better lives than to provide more prisons, that it costs less, has better results, and so forth. But there's no expectation that our government will act on that information.
That's right. If it collides with the interests of the 1%, then the government certainly will not implement it, actually. And that's why Obamacare, for example, is such an odd kind of patchwork quilt. It was a step forward, but it was tooth and nail, right, to get it through, because so many of the promising ideas were blocked by big pharmacy or big private hospitals or the big insurance companies. So it was necessary to come up with something that's very, very unwieldy and is falling, I think, of its own weight, because we didn't have what Barack Obama actually had said in 2008, which was, what we really need in this country is single-payer health care. That is, what we really need is Medicare for all. He knew that that is the rational system. It's the system of all the other rich countries. We're the outlier. He knew that that's the correct system, but he also didn't believe that the American people would fight for it. And yeah. He knew he couldn't make it happen because a president isn't a dictator in our country. A president gets vetoed by 1% whenever the president gets out of line in their opinion. And he didn't really believe that we had the guts to stand up and demand Medicare for all. And so that's why he went through all that negotiation and ended up with something that was a step forward, but, you know, part of that incrementalist thing that keeps us so frustrated.
Well, I'm not saying he's wrong about the U.S. public in 2008. I can't swear either way, but he did not campaign on single payer. He campaigned against it. Exactly. Dennis Kucinich campaigned for it and won far greater applause, but far less media support as a result. And President Obama sent the labor unions around banning anyone from their rallies who would have single payer on a sign, because they wanted to completely censor the idea from the conversation. So he may have, like we now know, Hillary Clinton admits in private that single payer is the only thing that works, and her husband actually blurts it out publicly now. But he didn't just hold off on that. He actively campaigned to oppose it, and so we haven't really given it a try with any sort of national political leadership.
It won't come from elected officials. It'll have to come from the grassroots. That's what I mean. If we were waiting for the elected officials, for example, to end legal racial segregation, we would still be waiting.
Right. And if it's up to them, we may get it back again. The other big factor, it seems to me here, maybe this is my curiously idiosyncratic impression, but none of these countries have $1 trillion a year militaries.
Right.
And we have all these endless discussions of economics in the United States, almost none of which even mention the existence of this thing that eats up over half of federal discretionary spending every year, a huge chunk of the U.S. economy, counterproductively, just in economic terms, dumped into this thing. And these other countries don't have it. Isn't this a big difference that weighs on this discussion?
Oh, yes, it does. Sure. The Scandinavian countries are not centers of an empire, and so they don't have to do all that military spending in order to dominate other countries around the world. And they wouldn't think of doing it, actually. I mean, if you ask the average Scandinavian, would you be willing to give up your excellent health care system and have one like the U.S. in order to in order to fund a big military,
right.
Are you kidding? Or would you be willing to give up free higher education, and in order to fund a big military, they would look at you like you were crazy.
Yeah. But the majority of people in the United States, as you know, would share their opinion as well, and would trade a chunk of the U.S. military. Of course, most people in the United States have no idea what the size of the U.S. military is, but once they're told, they would trade a huge chunk of it for a decent single-payer healthcare system or anything else. And of course, single-payer healthcare actually costs less than existing U.S. healthcare system. You don't actually have to trade anything to get it. But it seems like what's missing is organization. I mean, you cite in the 80s with this rightward push in the U.S. and Britain that
people in Scandinavia didn't just resist, but they went on the offensive, and they proposed and struggled for grander rights and policies and programs than were existent then. Whereas in the United States, the typical reaction to a right-wing proposal is to come out and wisely propose only half of it.
That's right.
How do we change that mentality?
How do we, David? I've been talking it up, especially since the election victory of Trump, because already I hear people wanting to go on the defensive. Let's try to defend Obamacare, defend previous gains and so on, which was exactly the wrong mistake that we made when Reagan came into office. People went on the defensive. One of the rare points where Gandhi and military generals agree is that you don't win anything on the defensive. You win through going on the offensive. And that is the strategic principle we need to adopt now, and that's what was successful in Scandinavia, as you said. They went on the offensive, and they kept pushing on behalf of a vision. Now, we do have a problem in the U.S. about there not being a broadly held vision of what it is we want. We've been way too fragmented. And, well, let's get at least decent law enforcement so the police aren't killing unarmed people, or let's do this specific thing.
Right.
But we haven't been very good at generating a vision. And the good news from Black Lives Matters is that on August 1st, the Movement for Black Lives did put out in public a vision of an economy that would support racial justice. And that was, frankly, tears came to my eyes when I read the substance of the vision, because it is not only because it is so broad, and there's been a tendency not, as I said, to be broad, but this is a really broad vision. But also, the reason I was so moved was that the vision is in alignment with the Nordic economic model.
Yeah.
Which means that the Movement for Black Lives is not coming up, you know, just out of its imagination with a utopian proposal, but they're actually proposing something that we know works because it has a 60-plus year track record of success, of outperforming the United States.
Yeah.
So it's a big step forward, and now is the time to go on the offensive on behalf of that vision, instead of going on the defense, which I hear too many people talking about. How could we defend this and protect that?
And that Black Lives Matter platform is actually right on foreign policy as well, which is incredibly rare in U.S. Left-leaning politics. So it is a wonderful vision and what we need. We have less than a minute left. I'm struck, in fact, by the fact that what you're proposing actually exists, and we're constantly hearing in the United States that it can't be done in theory. You know, how do we get people to look at the reality and learn from it?
Well, my book, I think, is already making a difference. The feedback I get from the Northwest, like Washington State and Alaska, where I've been most recently, but also in the Midwest, Iowa and North Dakota, and so, is people saying, thank you for explaining in clear terms in a very readable book, because they find it a page-turner. They say, hey, this isn't an economics text. And I say, of course it isn't.
Right.
So they say, this is practical. It's obviously practical for the United States. And here you describe it in detail with anecdotes and illustrations from where it's been operating.
Gotta leave it there, George.
That's the point of the book.
Wonderful. The book is Viking Economics. Highly recommend it. George Lakey, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for asking me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. corporate media's Fidel Castro is a cartoon in death no less than in life. While it's implied that our only choice is between hagiography and hatred, there is actual history that provides context for understanding the role of Castro and the Cuban Revolution, which involved more people than him, in history. We'll hear from Luis Perez, history professor at the University of North Carolina and author of, among other titles, Cuba Between Reform and Revolution. Also on the show, while much is uncertain, one thing we do know about the coming days is that those who hope to protect what Donald Trump threatens and resist what he seeks to impose will need to talk to one another. Few things are clearer than that corporate media are not the appropriate hosts for that conversation. Now there's an opportunity to shore up local and community news media as a resource. Craig Aaron, president of the group Free Press, will join us to talk about that. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. Watching the corporate media these days is interesting. How will an elite press corps, used to gesturing publicly toward independence while laughing behind closed doors at black-tie dinners with the powerful officials they're charged with scrutinizing, treat someone who straight up berates and threatens them? Early signs are discouraging. As FAIR associate Norman Solomon wrote for FAIR.org, the weather forecast points toward an evasive fog. Judging by the roundtable segment on the PBS NewsHour, November 21st, the news there was that Trump won't be traditional. As NewsHour regular Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report said, quote, "We have to stop treating Donald Trump like this is just a traditional, normal political candidate who's now going to be a traditional, normal president," close quote. Tamara Keith, a White House correspondent for NPR, then explained that Trump, quote, "has not related to the press or the public in a traditional way ever. And he's had an incredible skill at distracting, at creating." There was this movie Up, and there was a dog who gets distracted, and squirrel, squirrel. That's what happens, close quote. So here we have political journalists marveling at Trump's ability to create distractions while they keep themselves and their audience distracted, as Keith demonstrates. Quote, "Every time there is a story that is not favorable to him, like settling the Trump University lawsuit for $25 million, suddenly there is a Twitter fight. Meanwhile, he has skillfully avoided sort of the type of environment that a press conference creates, the environment where you get asked a question and then somebody else asks a question and then somebody else asks a question. It builds on it, and you really can't escape. There's nothing like a press conference." And his transition team is saying, well, you know, don't tell him what's traditional and what's conventional. This is Donald Trump, close quote. So right before your eyes, Keith veers away from mention of an actual issue, the Trump University fraud settlement, to focus on stagecraft and a sort of mythological idea of how press conferences work. Later on, she would say of Trump's cabinet appointments, quote, "the people that he's picked are the people we should be focusing on," close quote. But then they don't. At one point, someone says the name Jeff Sessions. Judy Woodruff says he has a record. Steve Bannon? Woodruff says he has a private sector record. Well, what were those records? Why do they matter? That didn't come up. The cherry on the sundae came at the end as Woodruff asked Walter, "Do we just get used to this?" The answer, yes, you have to just get used to all of this. As it happens, many people are coming to a very different conclusion. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Fidel Castro, who died November 25th at age 90, will be remembered as someone whose work changed not just Cuba, but the wider world. With U.S. media ringing with denunciation, with some left over to denunciate those who aren't denunciating enough, there's little oxygen left for discussion of that work and what it meant and still means. We're joined now for some context on Castro and Cuba by Luis Perez. He's professor of history at the University of North Carolina and editor of Cuban Journal and author of, among other titles, Cuba Between Reform and Revolution. He joins us now by phone from North Carolina. Welcome to Counterspin, Luis Perez.
Good day. How are you?
Well, to hear the TV talkers tell it, Fidel Castro was not just an evil monster, he was a sort of Svengali who somehow tricked millions of people into supporting his project. There's a sense that the only reason not to despise him is delusion, you know, and that seems to disavow any agency on the part of the Cuban people. Among other things, they're seen as engaging in some sort of idol worship. I have heard you say that Fidel resonates because the Cuban Revolution resonates. Can you give us some context for why that's the case?
The most extraordinary facet of the coverage of the last 5-6 days in this country has been the utter lack of self-reflection and ignorance of context. And I think you've used the word context already twice in your introductory comments. It is so easy, it is so facile to focus on one man. Americans love the great man thesis, one man to whom one can attribute everything that torments one. It is so easy to identify this, the outcomes in Cuba, the outcomes in Central America, the outcomes in Africa, to one guy. That liberates anybody from exploring context, from exploring process, from exploring history, from understanding how this phenomenon that Fidel Castro represents unfolds. And so what we have here is just an utterly one-dimensional assessment of the past and the present. And Fidel Castro is that evil person to whom one can attribute everything that one doesn't like about the world.
When Cubans talk about it, of course, there's a completely different approach to it and a completely different kind of reckoning with it. But as you say, U.S. readers have gotten, first of all, very little information, period. But then also the information has been kind of cartoonish. So what can you tell, and also for younger folks who don't know, what was the Cuban Revolution? What did it signify? What did it change?
The Cuban Revolution comes out of a history. It comes out of a struggle by a people that has its antecedents in the middle of the 19th century, and it represents successive generations of Cubans who aspire, however unlikely it would appear, coming from a little country, a small population. The Cuban historical purpose for 150 years has been given to the pursuit of self-determination and national sovereignty. If the Cuban Revolution is about anything, it's about self-determination and national sovereignty. And so that's an idea that goes back to the 1850s, and it's articulated by Jose Martí in the 1880s and 1890s, and it continues to kind of circulate, and it becomes a politics in Cuba with the inauguration of the Republic in 1902. So Fidel Castro comes out of that history. He is formed by that sensibility. And so what the Cuban Revolution represents on January 1959, and certainly this is the point that Fidel Castro makes, it is the culmination of a process. It is, finally, a people who have achieved self-determination and national sovereignty, and the obstacle in the 19th century was Spain, and the obstacle in the 20th century was the United States. So the revolution comes with this purpose of affirming Cuba for Cubans, and finally, the prospects of agency, of seizing hold of those forces that govern one's life. And that means inevitably to reduce the presence and the influence of the United States in Cuba. And that's the one condition that since the 19th century, the United States was not willing to acquiesce to Cuba. from Jefferson until George W. Bush and perhaps even Obama, the idea of Cuban national sovereignty and self-determination has been, and it continues to be, an anathema.
As in other places as well, but I think it's such an important understanding of the relationship. Reuters, in their write-up, said that Castro, quote, built a communist state on the doorstep of the United States, close quote, which I find funny, as though the proximity of this tiny island were an affront or a provocation to the United States. You know, it reminds me of the comic activist Professor Irwin Corey, who was a big supporter of the revolution. He told my colleague Steve Rendell that he had complained to Castro that for 40 years you've refused to remove your country from around our military base. You know, it is, of course, the relationship with the world superpower. It is that sovereignty that drew the admiration of people, of oppressed people the world over, that defiance, and how strange to present it still today as a threat to the United States.
Well, I think the word you use is correct, the affront. Castro was a breathing, living reminder of the limit of American power. How is it possible that the United States could not do something about this guy? And successive generations of American political leaders and 11 presidential administrations more or less all take power saying they're going to do something about Fidel Castro. The presidential terms come and go, and he's still there, and he survives the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the Cuban Revolution continues, admittedly limping, but still continues to survive. So I think it's that defiance that just galled Americans, their inability to will the world according to their wishes in a place that they had always willed the world. There's something profoundly psychological. Mm-hmm. Fidel Castro becomes a highly personal issue to Americans. And the multiple attempts to assassinate it can't make it any more personal than that. Mm-hmm.
Well, what you're talking about, the importance of sovereignty, and that, as I understand it, it became an overweening focus on sovereignty, and then the security state that is understandably lamented. Now, you see that as a kind of cautionary tale.
That's exactly how I see it. I see the Cuban development. Does the system resort to repressive techniques? Absolutely. Has it spawned an elaborate surveillance and intelligence system? Absolutely. It has done all these things. I think it's important to bear in mind that this has a context. This was a state, a government, administration, rulers, who were confronted with the most powerful country in the world that had as a single overriding determination regime change. And when the Cubans invoke national security, then all bets are off, as we are learning in this country. When one invokes national security, then civil liberties, constitutional freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of association, freedom of thought, all begin, that space begins to contract, get smaller and smaller. And, you know, again, when I said earlier the lack of self-reflection, I think anybody has to go to the Alien and Sedition Laws at the end of the 18th century after the American Revolution. When the Americans felt threatened by the French, and they passed the sedition laws, and anybody who published or said anything against the United States government would be subject to imprisonment. And how about the Japanese Americans, who the United States, feeling threatened by Japan, rounds up tens of thousands of Japanese Americans and puts them in camps? So it's that lack of context, it's that lack of appreciation of it's like people say, well, the economy is in shambles in Cuba. It is. But to what degree is the shambles of the Cuban economy the outcome of a punitive embargo that had as its direct purpose to make the Cuban economy one of shambles? So it is this loop of opinion that feeds on itself, and we just can't seem to break or get out of it.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, we had started to see, you know, it was being called a thaw. We saw some diplomatic relations being established earlier this year with Cuba. Now, you know, things are different. What do you imagine happening now in terms of the relationship between U.S., the United States, and Cuba, and what do you think would serve Cubans?
If the new incoming administration presumes to act on the utterances of this past weekend, then I think anybody, any persons of goodwill, any persons who derive comfort at the process of normalization of the last 2 years cannot but despair and feel very anxious. The words of the president-elect saying that he wants to withdraw the concessions, quote-unquote, unless the Cubans, among other things, open up their economy for market reform, free political prisoners, hold elections, allow parties, political parties. We are now going to be plunged back to the worst days of, I don't even know what the comparison would be, the Reagan years, the George W. Bush years, because these are the demands that the Cubans have resisted for 55 years, because this is, again, a throwback to the curtailment and the challenge to the Cuban insistence upon self-determination and national sovereignty. So if these folks who are coming in January proceed to act on those politics, then we're in for some very, very difficult times, U.S.-Cuba relations.
We've been speaking with Luis Perez, professor of history at the University of North Carolina and author of, among other books, Cuba Between Reform and Revolution. Luis Perez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're very welcome.
As big corporate media try to puzzle out whether they can get away with their usual lapdog routine with a president-elect who openly berates and threatens them, many people have already determined that big corporate media are not actually where they're going to be looking for the news and perspectives that we need to help us forward in these times and inform our resistance to a racist, sexist, anti-worker, anti-poor, anti-environment, anti-civil liberties administration. Just as many now look to states and local governments for legislative and policy protections, some see the local space as a site of hopefulness for news media as well. It's not just pipe dreams. There is a development on that front. And here to tell us about it is Craig Aaron, president of the group Free Press. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Craig Aaron.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Well, let's get right to it. I just read an article headlined, "A Chance to Invest Millions in the News and Information People Need." So what's the story?
Well, we have this really unique opportunity that I think could be one of the answers to how do we actually provide the journalism and meet the community information needs that have gone, you know, underserved or unserved for so long. And it basically works like this. The Federal Communications Commission is in the midst of auctioning off a big chunk of the public airwaves. And they're asking broadcasters, or they're not really asking, they're paying them, to go off the air or move their stations to another channel in order to create more space for mobile data. So they're going to move the TV stations out and turn around and auction off those airwaves to mobile phone companies and others. In the middle of all this are a number of public television stations, of at least 54 considering it by our count at Free Press. And we think these are public stations using the public airwaves with public interest obligations, and yet the public hasn't been brought into this conversation about what happens when these stations are auctioned off and what happens to all the money. And we're talking potentially about a lot of money, billions and billions of dollars that will go to the license owners of these stations. So when we're talking about public stations, these are state and local governments, universities, other nonprofit institutions. And we're particularly interested in the state of New Jersey, which owns four public TV stations valued by the FCC for as much as $2.3 billion. So even if only some of the stations are sold and the price comes down in the auction, which it will do, we could still be talking about hundreds of millions of dollars created going into the coffers of New Jersey. And we're stepping in to say we need to use some of that money to set up a permanent public fund that will actually support independent local journalism projects, public media, other innovative community information projects. And this is actually a chance to do it, a windfall, hundreds of millions of dollars that could be used to create the journalism that communities actually need.
So just to be clear, it's not that we would be calling for this to happen. It's happening. The question is, you know, the stations are selling off these airwaves. The question is what happens with the money and will the public have some say in that?
Exactly. So the auction is going to happen either way, and they're going to clear out these channels, something like channel 33 to 51 on the dial. There's not going to be TV stations there anymore. And so the question becomes, yeah, what happens to all of that money? You know, if Congress was doing their job, they would have already set aside some of these funds to support community information needs. But the fact is, you know, we think that we'd like to see all stations contribute, but we think these public stations, as public television stations, have an added obligation, and that the money from their sale shouldn't simply go to shore up some short-term state budget holes or fill out a university endowment, that we actually need to reinvest it in local communities. And the only way that that's going to happen is if we campaign and push for it. So that's what we're starting to do in New Jersey, depending on the final results of the auction. We don't know what those are yet. There may be other cities, that Washington, D.C., Chicago, that might benefit if indeed their stations are sold and are going off the air. It's a little bit of a black box while it's happening. The people in the auction can't actually talk about the auction, but we know that it's happening. We know that there are dozens of public television stations involved, and we know there are hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, at stake. And that question is, how should we spend that money? That's the part of the conversation we're looking to change.
Well, activists that I've been talking to have been saying they're not wanting to give up on the federal level, but they are saying we might look to local levels and the state levels for some interventions that could actually help real people in real time. You know, that the country is not just the president and the people, although media sometimes sort of present it that way, and not just in their content, but also in their structure. You know, we've seen a number of local outlets disappear. So a place like you're talking about, like New Jersey, they might get news from Philadelphia, they might get news from New York, but the big media conglomerates say, you don't really need to serve this specific community. You know, they'll be happy enough with news from the nearest big city. So there's a real void here that could be filled.
That's right, and I think this is one of those answers. The fact is that the corporate media, the market, has not been providing news in these places in huge parts of our country where, you know, tens of thousands of journalists lost their job. We're quickly approaching, you know, we're going to have half the number of daily journalists working than we had a couple of decades ago. There's so much going uncovered at the local level, you know, in the places where people really can make a difference. But those school board meetings and those activities of local officials, they're simply not being covered, even all the way up to our members of Congress and senators who used to have, you know, five or six reporters following them around. Maybe there's one now. So much is going uncovered, and we see the impact at the local level. You know, more corruption, less money's brought home to districts, less accountability, all the way up to, you know, the election of Donald Trump. A lot of this could be laid right at the feet of this media failure and the fact that journalism institutions are really weak at a moment where we need them to be stronger. So we have to start looking for other answers. We just can't hope it will work out. We've got to find other sources to get the kind of news and information we need to actually have a functioning democracy. You know, there's really that much at stake. So I think we do have to look at the state level. There's a lot of defense to be played at the federal level to try to protect the victories we've had, to try to protect the most vulnerable who are going to be the first in line when all of these terrible changes happen. But at the same time, we got to look for opportunities like this that, you know, offer a different vision, offer some long-term change, and really kind of build, for lack of a better word, sanctuaries at the city and state level against what's happening in these national trends.
Well, we know that the void that we're talking about is there for a reason. It's not that people said they didn't care about local news. You know, it's not that people said, as we often hear, oh, well, we have the internet, we don't need that anymore. You know, people have always been interested in news at their community level, but the policy changes have been enabled by the FCC, which has been sort of slowly, steadily eroding the public interest obligations, you know, that would protect those things. And on that front, we now may have an administration that wants to straight out eliminate the FCC, which would seem to make that these kinds of efforts even more important.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, that is something we're worried about, you know, not necessarily that the FCC, the building, will disappear, but that you basically won't be able to tell the difference of whether there's an FCC or not. And the kind of folks that the Trump administration is putting on the transition team, the likely candidates to take over there, have a really dangerous and damaging agenda. And you can see already every big corporate player lining up with their wish list of the things that they haven't been able to get done for the last 10 years. You know, they're going to try to gut media ownership limits. They're coming for net neutrality. They're going to try to prevent poor people from getting broadband, even, you know, doing away with fixes to, you know, overcharging on prison phones. I mean, all the way down the list, they're going to come for those policies. We're going to have to fight that. But we're also going to have to build alternatives. And one thing about political moments like this is that they're moments of clarity. And the question, you know, the question that FAIR's been asking forever about the failures of the corporate media, well, those aren't questions anymore.
Right.
If they were, you know,
right.
the evidence is in, and we've got to start talking about how are we going to build an alternative. We think using these public resources in smart ways that actually serve local communities, that are actually innovative, that actually go out and ask people what kind of news and information they want, is a big part of that. Because if they start seeing the stories they actually care about, their communities reflected in a real way, a lot more people are going to care about the future of journalism and the future of news when it's actually benefiting their lives and not doing what it's done for far too long, which is frankly misrepresenting and harming them.
We've been speaking with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press. They're online at freepress.net, and that's where you can also get involved in their actions around this spectrum auction. Craig Aaron, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org, and that's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Get ready. We're going to visit the hot Arctic, where the winter sea ice is almost refusing to form. It's at a record low for November. Climate scientist Paul Beckwith will tell us why the sea ice around the world is in retreat and what it means for our weather. Yes, we'll get to Trump, the chances of hope, and the planetary climate emergency. Then something completely different. From the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions, Dr. Klaus Lackner will explain our options for capturing carbon right from the atmosphere. It may be our only chance to save the climate we all need to survive. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. In the summer of 2007, you could hear the thud of scientists' jaws dropping all over the world as they watched the Arctic sea ice almost vanish. It was a world wake-up call on global warming. This year, as we languished in the media tsunami of the American election, there has been another great turning point. It's like a climate change siren blaring from the dark Arctic sea, and we are just too far away to hear it. But know it or not, we will suffer the consequences. Here to explain is one of our favorite climate scientists and Arctic watcher, Paul Beckwith. Paul has two master's degrees. He's working on his PhD on extreme climate change. He teaches at the University of Ottawa in Canada, and he educates us all with his YouTube videos. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
Well, you know, talking with you, Paul, it's kind of like visiting the emergency room doctor. It's not because we're doing great. This time we've got a broken Arctic. What's the big deal there?
Well, I guess the point is that all of the data from the Arctic is unprecedented. You know, at the risk of being attacked by Washington Post for saying unprecedented, as I was on the jet streams, like there's no other way to describe it. The temperatures are off the chart, 20 degrees Celsius temperature anomaly, so that's 20 degrees Celsius warmer than normal, which is 36 degrees Fahrenheit for our American listeners. As a result, the ice is not forming properly, where the sea ice minimum occurred on September 8th or 9th, which is surprised a lot of people because people expected with the rates of decline that it would be maybe a week or two later. You know, even normally it's about mid-September. And as the ice is trying to grow in extent now, as we move through end of November into through winter, then the ice tries to grow, but the water surrounding the ice is very, very warm, much warmer than normal, and that's just melting it back. And also there's tremendous amounts of the thickest ice in the Arctic, which is bunched up just north of the Canadian archipelago, which is being exported by the wind patterns through the Fram Strait between Greenland and Svalbard. And this ice is going into the open Atlantic Ocean and completely being melted out extremely fast there. So we're also having a lot of ice that has moved between the islands and the Canadian archipelago, and that's also melting. You know, this is happening on a continuous basis. There will be a lot of variation, but, you know, we set the second lowest record with the September minimum ice extent, and now we've been setting records for as lowest ice this time of year. And it's because the Arctic temperatures, they're 2 months behind in terms of cooling down. I mean, we're basically seeing temperatures in the Arctic now that we should be seeing in September.
All right. Now, just to be clear, was the Arctic sea ice at an all-time record low this summer of 2016?
This summer, it was the second lowest. It was behind the previous record of 2012, and it was very close but slightly lower than the previous record of 2007 that you talked about in the introduction.
But now the problem is it should be forming and hardening up and getting ready for another season, and it's just not doing it the way it's supposed to.
Yes, that's correct. As it attempts to grow, which it does every year, we have very good satellite data from 1979 onward, and you can compare the curves of all of the years, and we're well below where we would be expected to be this year. Not only that, the sea ice in Antarctica is dropping off of a cliff, and it's much lower than we've ever seen it there. So when you look at the total global sea ice on the planet, then because of the rapid drop in Antarctica and because of the record lows in the Arctic, they add to something which is completely off the charts. I mean, it's just, this is a measure of how quickly our planet is warming from all of the feedbacks that are in play.
Well, that's one of the things the doubters tend to say. They say, well, maybe it's shrinking in the Arctic, but the Antarctic sea ice is expanding, so the poles are just balancing out. Who cares? But they're behind the times now. That isn't what's happening, as you've just said.
Yeah, it's just the most striking plot is actually, if you look at the graph of global sea ice, which is Arctic plus Antarctic, and it's because we're setting records at both poles, the combination is the most striking. Yeah, I mean, our climate system is changing in ways that were, are they unexpected? Well, with these type of temperatures, you expect the ice to melt much faster. But, you know, these type of temperatures that we're seeing at the poles are way off the scale. In fact, if you compare this year's temperature to pre-industrial, you know, we're well over that 1.2, 1.3 degrees. There were entire months, for example, the entire month of February was almost up to that 2 degrees above the pre-industrial 1750 sort of values, because from 1750 to sort of the 1880 to 1910 average, there was about a 0.3 degrees Celsius rise. From the 1880 to 1910 average to the 1950s to 80 average, say, there was another 0.3 roughly, and then you need to add the 1.25 that everybody's talking about, but that's relative to, you know, the 1950 to 81 averages roughly, so then you get a total of 1.95 degrees for February 2016 over the 1750 value. So we're talking about Paris levels, that 2-degree limit in Paris, you know, well above the 1.5 degrees. I mean, that's just for 1 month, granted, but, you know, when the tally comes in for 2016 overall, you know, we're going to be way off of the charts. And, you know, also we will be for CO2 rise as well. I mean, the CO2, which is very worrying because the global sinks of carbon dioxide, namely the oceans and the soils and the vegetation, the trees and so on, are failing. And as a result, the International Energy Agency numbers, which are showing supposedly that human emissions have stabilized, you know, are expected to be similar in 2016 to 2015, which was not much higher than 2014 or 2013. So kind of flattening off. And yet we're setting, in 2015, the CO2 rose a record 3.05 parts per million. And this year, I wouldn't be surprised if it's between 4 and 5 parts per million rise. So this is a very rapid acceleration, and it must indicate that the global sinks are reducing. The oceans are warmer, more stratified, so they're not absorbing as much of the CO2. We're getting tremendous fires in the boreal forests and also destruction of the Amazon rainforests, and so we're losing the sinks, the carbon dioxide sinks on the planet. So it's getting out of control. I mean, we need to declare a global climate change emergency.
All right. Well, you are like visiting the emergency room, doctor. So before we get to some of your solutions, I do want to get back to the Arctic science. And even before we do that, though, I think people need to realize that these changes in the sea ice, even in the fall, could affect us right here where most of us live, in North America, in Europe, in Russia. How does that work?
Yes. Well, the Arctic is getting darker because we're getting a rapid decline of sea ice, which is a white surface that reflects a lot of incoming sunlight during the summers in the Arctic. And as bad as the sea ice decline is, the snow cover over the land in the spring is declining at about double the rate that the sea ice is declining. And Greenland is melting a lot more, and we're getting lakes forming on the surface, which have are dark surfaces on top of the white ice. And as the ice melts back, it's uncovering a lot of the dust and dirt and stuff that's embedded in the ice. So the whole Arctic region is darkening, and it used to reflect on average, about 52% of the incoming solar radiation. And now, according to NASA, it's as of a few years ago even, it was reflecting only 48% of the incoming light. So that additional 4% of light is being absorbed by the surface, leading to additional heating in the Arctic, which is causing the Arctic temperatures to rise much larger than the global average, and certainly much larger than the equator temperature, because the equator temperature doesn't change too much. When there's more heat at the equator, there's more evaporation of water, which doesn't raise the temperature. So that kind of moderates and keeps the equator temperature somewhat stable. You know, if you live in a city on the equator, your yearly average temperature might only vary about 2 or 3 degrees. So what this means is that the temperature difference from the equator to the Arctic is getting much, much smaller as the Arctic is warming. And it's this temperature difference that determines the jet streams, how they form at the altitude the planes fly. And it also affects how wavy they are, how fast they are. So they're slowing down because the temperature difference is reduced, and they're becoming wavier and getting stuck. And this is causing the increase in extreme weather events that we're seeing. So we're seeing a higher frequency of torrential rains, for example, much more severe extreme weather, and also the duration is, these events are lasting longer. So we're getting many cities flooded out because their infrastructure just cannot handle 3, 4, 5 months of rain in a night or two, which is happening commonly at cities. So we're changing basically the heat balance on the planet. Heat moves from hot areas, the equator, to the poles, and it does it about a third of the heat's transported in the ocean currents, two-thirds in the atmosphere. And because the poles are so much warmer, there's less heat transfer. So the current ocean currents are changing. The atmospheric currents, namely the jet streams, are changing. So there's more heat moving to the southern hemisphere as a result, and that heat is changing. It's also causing extreme weather events in the southern hemisphere. So it's a global issue, and things are changing so fast. I mean, the flora and fauna, plants and animals, are stressed, and they're migrating quickly, and we're getting human migration as well, which is leading to nationalism and popularism and things like Brexit and Trump.
Well, I think you were the one who coined the phrase, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. And for those paying attention, it's been brutally cold in Eastern Europe and even worse in Russia and Central Siberia, and they expect cold winters. There have been hundreds of record low temperatures. They've had to close schools. The daytime temperature failed to reach minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 34 C. Japan just had their first November snow in 54 years. It almost looks like what should have been the polar cold has slipped down into the Asian continent. Could that be related to changes in the Arctic or the unpredictability you've been talking about?
Yes. Coincidentally, just in the last half hour, I've been reading some papers from Nature magazine, the latest issue, and there's one particular one about how the polar vortex has shifted over towards Asia and Europe in the last 30 years. And they correlate it to the declining sea ice, but it's not just, the sea ice is not declining uniformly in all regions of the Arctic. So if you look at the Barents Sea, which is, and the Kara Sea, which are just off Russia, those regions have lost most of their sea ice for long periods of the year. That's where the ice has decreased more than any other region. So what this does is this adds a lot of water vapor to the atmosphere over that region. That water vapor ends up going over Russia and over parts of Europe, and it drops down on the land as snowfall. So those areas are getting more snowfall. And as a result, the polar vortex has shifted over where it used to be centered right over the sort of the Arctic Ocean region, more or less centered over, you know, the geometrical center of the planet. And because of the changing ice distribution, it's shifted over, and we're getting, as a result, we're getting this massive cold weather over Siberia and parts of Europe with all the snowfall that you just mentioned. And what we're also getting is the whole polar vortex, which is generally the winds, the high altitude winds in the stratosphere over the Arctic. Those are actually often being split into two different cold regions, one over the Arctic and one over Asia and Europe. And the split generally occurs right above the Barents and Kara Seas, where the water is exposed, the ice is gone, so those areas are heating up, and that comes up and that can split the vortex into two chunks. And that seems to have happened recently, with the chunk over the Arctic almost dissipating, whereas the one over Asia is much colder and more intense. You have to remember that there's a certain amount of heat on the planet, and that heat, even though there's rapid changes occurring, that amount of heat can't change too quickly. So if the Arctic is crazy warm, where did that cold go? It's got to be somewhere. I mean, it's, you know, over, we're very quickly losing it on the planet, but, you know, you don't lose it in a season. So it's actually been shifting over to Asia and Europe.
You've just taught me something obvious that I didn't really know. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your downer host, Alex Smith. My guest is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. Paul, you recently released a couple of really helpful videos full of graphics on YouTube about this Arctic sea ice problem in November. You talked about wave action. It seemed a little technical, but what should the average person understand about waves and sea ice?
Well, I guess the important thing is that we're changing the physical nature of all the processes that are occurring in the Arctic. So when the sea ice covers ocean water, then as the sea ice thickness increases, then it's a very good insulator of heat. So it keeps the water temperature underneath separated from the air temperature. So basically, when the Arctic is covered with sea ice, it acts more as a continent than as an ocean, in terms of it can get very cold, the air is very dry. So as we lose more and more sea ice, we're turning the Arctic Ocean into a maritime climate. And the feedbacks are extremely strong, because the energy that does come into the Arctic from the sun in the summer, normally a lot of it is used up in melting the sea ice. But when the ice is a lot thinner and not covering as much area or extent, then that energy, it can take out the sea ice quickly, and then it heats up the water to extremely high temperatures. And then the water, because of wave action, there's vertical mixing in the water, so that heat gets transferred down. So you get maybe all the way down to the seafloor if you're on over a continental shelf like the Eastern Siberian Shelf or the Kara Shelf or the Barents Shelf, like just near the coastlines of Russia. So the water can warm all the way down, and then it's that heat can be transferred through the ocean sediment and start thawing out the methane clathrates that are there. And then we start getting more methane coming up, and we're seeing this in the Arctic region. And there's all of these different effects that are happening there, which are rapidly changing the planet. Now, Antarctica is a bit more of a mystery, because generally the sea ice there has been growing at about 1.5% per decade over the last few decades in terms of the seasonal extent. And just 2 years ago in 2014, we had a record amount of sea ice around Antarctica that season. It was a very unusual event. It was like one, you know, less than one in 100 year event, I would say. You know, if you look at the statistics, it was well outside two standard deviations. And if that means anything to people, it was anyway, it was very unusual. And then this year, it's a record low and it's plummeting down. So I covered all of these things with some nice graphics and things. They're on my website, paulbeckwith.net. And I did three videos, which I titled Our Climate Emergency and Three-Legged Barstool Survival, I called it. You know, solutions is what I'm really looking at. But, you know, the system is becoming very strange, so I threw in the word survival. And those videos, if you just Google YouTube, Paul Beckwith, you can find these videos. And I'm going to be doing quite a few more on how that's affecting the methane in the Arctic, and among other topics. I mean, I've done well over 100 videos now to try to educate the public about, you know, the risks that we face from climate change. And I've been trying to build the case that, you know, we're in a climate change emergency. The ridges of the jet streams run right up to the North Pole, cause, you know, heating there in the middle of winter. The troughs run right down to the equator, and I argue they cross the equator, joining up with the southern hemisphere jet stream. So we're basically losing seasonality in the northern hemisphere very rapidly. And even the jet stream, the way they operate and the way they carry heat is another enormous feedback to warm the entire northern hemisphere.
Now, you know Dr. Peter Wadhams. He's one of the world's most experienced Arctic scientists. He's the head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at Cambridge. He's a veteran of many expeditions to measure the ice, and he's released a new book this year, A Farewell to Ice. Have you spoken to Peter about the failure of this ice formation this fall?
Peter has been at Marrakesh at the COP22 climate conference, I believe under the invitation of Stuart Scott, who you've had on your program before. You've also had Peter. And Stuart did a whole bunch of press conferences at the COP, including on things like, you know, the impact of meat on climate change. He had a whole session on population. So he tried to hit the big elephants in the room that people don't want to discuss. And he had an entire two press conferences, I believe, Peter, maybe three, but one of them was specifically on the book, on Peter's book, A Farewell to Ice. And another one was on, you know, what's happening right now in the climate system. So I believe those videos, those sessions are all recorded. I believe those videos could probably be found if you go to the websites on the conference. But I know that Stuart will be editing them and posting them all on his YouTube channels. And I'll make sure they send you all the links so you can post some of them so the listeners can see them easily.
Yeah, Stuart sent me an email just yesterday. He just met the Pope, for one thing, briefly, but he met him. And he put a couple of links to some of those videos from Marrakesh, Morocco. But as you say, most of them are still awaiting editing. I'll put the links as they come up in my show blog at ecoshock.info. But please do keep me posted as well. Now, what else have I got here for you? Yeah, we're getting close to out of time, but I did want to get your reaction to Donald Trump. Kevin Anderson, when I spoke to him, worried that another 4 years of lies or delay and more coal could be the very critical 4 years we had to save the climate. Do you think the Donald will doom us, Paul?
Well, so, you know, there's a lot of people that are talking like that, and people talking about it's going to be too late, right, is often said. And I did a whole YouTube video on, you know, what is really too late mean, because it's already too late for millions of people on our planet. Like if you're living in Bangladesh near sea level, you know, the rise is going to displace you. It's just a matter of time, whether it be 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, you know, 20 years, whatever. You know, is it too late for, you know, us in, say, Canada? There's such an imbalance between the effects of climate change depending on where people live and depending on the wealth of countries. If you're in a country where people spend a third or a half of their income on food, then those people are going to be basically unable to purchase food in a short number of years when abrupt climate change continues to accelerate and severely damages the food supply. I was just at a talk last week by an emeritus professor with Department of Fisheries and Oceans talking about fish farming and the decline of fish in the oceans. He also talked a bit more generally about food, and in the Nature paper that was talking about the polar vortex shifting, there's an article with about 30 different author names, and it's all about decline of yields of grains with temperature. And I skimmed the abstract, and it was pointing out about a 4 to 6% decline in grain yields globally with a 1 degree rise in temperature. Now, that I'm sure it's not taking into account things like the declining sea ice and feedbacks that are kicking in, and it's certainly not taking into account the rises in temperature that we've seen this year in 2016 and the rises in CO2, et cetera, things like that. So whatever Trump does, there's going to be huge impacts. And I think Trump, you know, he says he's a smart businessman. If he's a smart businessman, he'll recognize that gutting the EPA and gutting NASA and climate change research will put the U.S. into a huge recession, and it will basically, you know, have an enormous impact on reducing their technology, their ability to supply the military with advanced weapons. I mean, it will basically crater the economy of the U.S., which will perhaps reduce emissions more than, say, you know, somebody who's experienced and doesn't do these policies, you know, on the top of their head. The big concern is it takes decades to build up an organization like NOAA, for example, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and these centers of excellence that do tremendous work with the satellites. And it takes decades. And if these can be killed with the stroke of a pen on inauguration day, I mean, we're never going to have a chance against climate change. Other countries in Europe, say, get more populist. Ironically, we're getting more migration around the planet because of the impacts of climate change. So to deny that that's causing it is going to make it worse, and the there's going to be way more migration, and it's going to just set us into a really, really dire global situation. So we need rationality in the decisions that we make. And I do propose, you know, a three-pronged approach to slash fossil fuel emissions, to apply carbon dioxide removal, remove CO2. We need to get the levels back down to 350, and also to cool the Arctic, to keep the methane in place, the sea ice in place, try to restore some stability to the jet streams. And with Trump, you know, that really harms, say, leg one of the bar stool, the slashing emissions. And, you know, it certainly means maybe we have to go whole hog on leg two and three. But I can't see how we can let one person, no matter who they are, destroy the work of hundreds of other countries. I mean, what, we have 195 countries, you know, in the Paris Agreement, and we're going to say one guy in one country, albeit they have a huge influence, can take down global efforts at retooling to renewables and addressing climate change? Yeah, it really doesn't make sense.
Well, they say it's always darkest just before the dawn, and I trust we'll live long enough to see the dawn. We've been talking with a regular and quite popular guest here on Radio EcoShock in Canada. Paul Beckwith is a climate scientist at the University of Ottawa. He has thousands of followers on his Twitter feed, Facebook page, and YouTube channel. You can get your own education in climate science practically just from Paul's videos. They're available from his website as well at paulbeckwith.net. It's a place to be for science before it's news, I think. Paul, thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's always wonderful to talk to you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. So here we have it, the incoming leader of the alleged free world, President-elect Donald Trump, on climate change.
A Well, first of all, I'm not a believer in global warming. I'm not a believer in man-made global warming. It could be warming, and it's going to start to cool at some point. And, you know, in the 1920s, people talked about global cooling. I don't know if you know that or not. They thought the Earth was cooling. Now it's global warming. So I am not a believer, and I will, unless somebody can prove something to me, I believe there's weather, I believe there's change, and I believe it goes up, and it goes down, and it goes up again, and it changes depending on years and centuries.
Trump's senior advisor, former longtime Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, Robert Walker, told The Guardian newspaper and Canada's CBC Radio that the Trump administration would cancel all climate change monitoring and research funding at NASA, the world's premier operator of the satellites and science. Make it go dark, that should solve the problem. If there is intelligent life anywhere in the universe, we need you now. Radio EcoShock is independent radio funded by listeners. We don't have any corporate sponsors. Our goal is to produce deep green radio for the world, or at least for the English speakers of this world. Our partners are the nonprofit community radio stations who broadcast this shocking news every week. Wherever you are, please support your local radio station. We need that freedom of the airwaves now more than ever, don't you think? It looks like we're headed for a different and a difficult climate, unless humans can reverse our pollution by grabbing greenhouse gases right out of the sky. Recently on Radio EcoShock, Dr. Kevin Anderson explained the hazards of counting on carbon capture and storage as we continue to pollute the atmosphere. His paper was published in the journal Science in October 2016. On November 11th, Science published a reply with a more positive view of carbon capture. The author is Dr. Klaus S. Lackner. He's the director of the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions and a professor at Arizona State University. Lackner got his doctorate at physics at Germany's Heidelberg University. He started in atomic work, including a period at Los Alamos National Lab. Then Klaus branched into climate research, including contributing to a report on carbon capture and storage for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Klaus Lackner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Dr. Lackner, why did you write a reply to the paper, The Trouble with Negative Emissions, by Anderson and Peters?
Well, first of all, it wasn't just me. That is the way it came out in Science, because we had 45 authors, and they relegated the majority to the supplement because they couldn't make room enough in the main pages for such a long list of authors. So it wasn't just me. But I was the one who started it, but then we had a large group of people who not only signed up but helped with the editing and replying to this perspective in Science.
Why did you feel a reply was necessary?
I think the reply is necessary because the way it came across in the perspective, it was not so much that we shouldn't just count on negative emissions. I'm the first person to agree that we shouldn't count on the ability to do this until we actually have done it. But it sort of relegated it as a unjust and high-risk gamble, and thereby sort of implied that we should try to solve the problem just without it. And I don't think that is actually feasible anymore. I actually think we are in a position right now where we most likely will overshoot even if we put in best possible efforts. But we may find that even negative emissions cannot solve the problem anymore. But keeping that half of the response out of the mix is probably an equally risky proposition. In effect, we are already past this point, and even the paper makes it quite clear. It points out that we are currently at 404 parts per million, and going up by two and a half parts per million a year. And if we want to stop at 450 parts per million, we probably cannot do this anymore.
Your article is titled The Promise of Negative Emissions. Let's talk about that in detail. First, please tell us what the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions does.
Well, I started from the perspective that we probably will need negative emissions to balance the carbon budget. So my view of it is, in a way, quite simple. We should think of carbon dioxide we are producing in the consumption of fossil fuels as a waste product we just dump into the atmosphere. And we have by now figured out that we are not allowed to dump it there. And thinking about it as a waste problem rather than a pollution problem actually changes the way you think about it. And I can give you a simple example. If I were to dump my garbage in the street, my neighbors would be very unhappy with me and probably call the cops on me. And they wouldn't take it for an answer that I said, but I thought about it very hard and I made it a lot better by reducing my garbage production and conserving where I can. And this year, it's actually 20% less than last year. But in the climate change debate, we do exactly that. We actually set targets how much we want to reduce this year, where really we have to take the point of view, this is garbage. It's dumped into the atmosphere, and we have to stop doing this. And we may have to take some of it back because we already put so much out that we are over the limit we can possibly afford being out there. So that's where our starting point was. And if you look at the IPCC, you can say that the modelers just willy-nilly invented technologies to have negative emissions. But the other way of looking at it is that the modelers were unable to balance the carbon budget in time without having such negative emissions. So to me, it's not so much a question of will the negative emissions work, but what can we do to make them work?
Do you think, though, that the Paris Climate Agreement, which begins with such low demands for reducing national emissions, could they do that if they didn't assume carbon capture technology in the future?
Well, they are starting to put some ambition behind what we should do, and they are asking people to make promises. And if you add up all the promises, it falls woefully short from what needs to be done. Paris, on the other side, is very ambitious. Paris says we have to hold the line below 2-degree warming, and they then turn around and say we should actually stop at 1.5-degree warming. I would make the argument we probably are already at 1.5-degree warming. And the way I mean this is not that we right now have reached 1.5-degree warming, but if we could, by some technology, hold the CO2 level in the atmosphere at about 400 parts per million, it will still get warmer for decades and decades to come because the climate hasn't yet equilibrated to 400 ppm. The oceans still act as a cool spot in the system. We have sort of ice cubes in the glass, and it hasn't warmed up yet, right? So as a consequence, it is not at all clear that if we waited 50, 60 years at 400 parts per million, that we haven't effectively already breached the 1.5 ppm. Therefore, if we want to stay below it, we really will have to pull CO2 back. If the agreement is 2-degree warming is where we should hold the line, then we probably end up around 450 parts per million. Now, at the current rate of emission, that will take us about 16 years.
I understand. Well, now, could you explain for us one of the technologies that people seem to favor, BECCS, the bioenergy with carbon capture and storage idea?
Well, you now are looking for negative emissions, right? And one where we actually know how to do it is BECCS, right? If your power plant were to burn wood rather than coal, and you still collect the CO2 in the flue stack, and you still bury that CO2, then you have created a negative emission, right? What's nice about this particular technology is there is not all that much new that needs to be invented. What's problematic with this technology is that if you wanted to do it at the scale you need to do it, you probably would need more land assigned to BECCS than we currently assign to agriculture. So I don't think by itself it will ever get big enough. It can help. There is not a single solution to the problem. It's sort of one arrow in the quiver. but we need additional options. So we are working on technology and technological means of pulling CO2 back out of the atmosphere. In other words, we are looking at sorbents which bind CO2, and then we can take the CO2 back off the sorbent and keep doing this cycle, so we collect CO2 by that means.
Well, would we have pools of that solvent or something? How would that work?
In our particular case, actually, with one exception, the people who are doing this use solid materials. So in our case, it's a plastic-like material that when it's dry has a very high affinity to CO2, and when you make it wet, it gives it back. So the picture is it's like a tree. It's a, we call it a synthetic tree that stands out in the wind, and the leaves of that tree bind CO2 as the wind moves over it, and then ever so often, roughly every an hour, we collect those into a closed box, make it wet, and harvest the CO2 that comes off, process it further on in order to make pure compressed CO2, and then the wet leaves go back into the outside, they dry in the wind, and pick up CO2 again. So that's how you could imagine to do this. And this particular technology and most of the air capture devices are about 1,000 times faster than a tree. The tree is not specialized to collect CO2. It does it because it needs to, but it does many other things.
Do we have the technology right now to capture carbon from smokestacks of power plants?
Yes, we do. We have had this for a long time because we used it for other purposes. We never built it out to a scale where it deals with the CO2 from power plants. But that's just half of the story, right? You fly in an airplane and you drive a car and you move freight over the oceans by ship. All of these things emit CO2. As a matter of fact, the hardest part of the equation to solve is the CO2 which is generated from liquid fuels, right, in the transportation sector. And we cannot leave that out. In other words, we cannot solve the carbon dioxide problem by removing 90% of the CO2 from flue stacks, which make up maybe a third of the total.
Well, supposing we do get it from the flue stacks or we collect it in these trees that you've described, how do we store it?
I don't think at this point we have a choice anymore. It's a simple mass balance. As long as we dig up carbon from the ground, we will have to put it back, right? And it is quite likely that we already overshot. And even if you do the best you can possibly do, you nearly certainly have overshot. And so very likely we will have to take 100 ppm of CO2, which are in the air, get it back and put it somewhere. Right. So from that perspective, we have no choice. Now, there are multiple options. The currently most favored option, because it's relatively low in cost, is to inject it into underground saline aquifers and keep it there. Right. That has a certain amount of capacity. Whether it has enough can be argued. I had started in 1995 to say we should really do what I would call accelerated geological weathering. If you look at certain rocks, they will react with the CO2 in the air, which in rain comes down as carbonic acid, and make salts, namely carbonates. And if we wait about 100,000 years, that's how the problem we created right now will go away. Right? But the question is, can we do this faster and make mineral carbonates at the scale we need to do? And for example, there is a project in Iceland where people are putting CO2 underground and show that the Icelandic basalts actually form carbonates in less than 2 years. So there are ways of storing carbon dioxide. Unless we are comfortable to live well above 450 parts per million, I think we already have removed the option not to deal with it. And so I don't view carbon sequestration as an excuse to keep on using fossil fuels. I view it as something we probably already have to do in order to balance the books. If 350.org is right or James Hansen is right, and we should not exceed 350 ppm in the air in the long run, we will not get back to 350 ppm in a very, very long time unless we actively remove carbon dioxide from the air and store it somewhere.
Well, that somewhere can be a problem. I mean, we just saw the deep storage well for natural gas blow out at Aliso Canyon in California. They couldn't stop it for 4 months. What happens if a carbon storage facility leaks out the carbon we thought was safely stored down there?
then you are right back where you were if you had ignored the problem, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Let me add on this a little. If you can pull CO2 back out of the air, you can actually get it back. Unlike the methane, which comes out of that well, the CO2, unless it's really coming out in vast, vast quantities at one spot, is actually not hazardous, right? It goes into the air and it creates exactly the climate change it would have created if you had let it out in the first place. But if you say, I happen to have just lost 1 million tons of CO2, then in a way you are on the hook to collect another 1 million tons of CO2 and put it back, which is another reason why air capture is so important, right? Because it makes it possible to undo the damage you did. And I think one of the reasons which makes it so hard to move forward, and this is another point where I disagree with Anderson, what makes it so hard to move forward, if I am an emitter and I emit it and you complain, I'm going to shrug my shoulders and say, what are you going to do about it? Right? But if you have the ability to create negative emissions, you can go back and say, well, I pulled it back and you are liable for doing this. You are going to pay for this change. You'd be surprised how fast people will figure out that they are better off to not let the CO2 out in the first place than having to pay for pulling it back later. In other words, I don't see negative emissions necessarily as a way of delaying things. It certainly will have that effect, but it also will accelerate action by making it possible to hold you liable and actually force action which undoes what you just did. Right? And that is new once you have negative emissions. If you have air capture, I give you a simple example. Right now, most of the coal industry says, we understand there is climate change and we are researching to find solutions, but it's so expensive you don't want to do it. And by the way, you need our cooperation. As long as we tell you it's too expensive, nothing will happen. But if you can tell the coal company or the utility which burns coal, okay, that's fine, but then you have to pay for the air capture which will reverse the CO2 emissions, you'd be surprised how fast they figure out that they can be faster. Right? Air capture shouldn't be for coal plants. It should be for airplanes, where you really have a very hard time coming up with another option. But if coal plants do not cooperate, you can always force them to solve the problem this way.
Radio EcoShock.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is a distinguished scientist and a leader in the hunt for a way to prevent the worst of climate change. He's Dr. Klaus Lackner from the Arizona State University. You raised a point just now that kind of stimulated me. You said, well, we can go back. And my reading from the scientists I've talked to is likely we can't go back in any ecological way. So many changes have already been put into motion, but at least we could stop the worst from happening. Now, what do you think about that?
I would 100% agree with what you just said, right? And therefore, I always say the ability to have negative emissions, the ability to have air capture is not an excuse to do nothing. Because as we go forward, we create irreversible damages, right? The fact that we come back down in CO2 will not unmelt the glaciers. Once they are molten, once the glaciers have gone away, it'll take a long, long time for them to come back. So yes, you have irreversible damage, but if your choice is to end up at 500 ppm and stay there, or touch on 500 ppm and come back to 350, which of the two do you think is better?
Absolutely. Now, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions about other technologies that have been advanced. France is proposing changes to agriculture to put more carbon in the soil. It's called the 4 per 1,000 project. What are your thoughts on that as a solution?
I think there are many, many different ways of putting carbon away. And what we need is accounting schemes and metrics which clearly define that we have done that. So what I would like is a certificate of sequestration, or if you prefer, a certificate of negative emissions, which can show you that it has been put away. Then many different things can play. And I would argue BECCS, as well as hiding carbon in agricultural fields, can be a good contributor. I am doubtful that it can reach the necessary scale. We are putting 36 billion tons of CO2 out a year, and I don't think you can come close to that. And in a way, we have worried about deforestation, as being a contributor to climate change, but it's a small contributor to climate change. Fossil fuels are the big one, and so doing the opposite will be helpful, but it will not solve the problem.
I'm told Bill Gates is funding research into carbon capture. What do you know about that?
Well, there is a group in Canada Bill Gates has funded, and they are doing very good work. So that's carbon engineering.
And is the U.S. government funding negative emissions research, or would you expect that support to continue under the Trump administration?
It's hard to tell. I mean, it's early days. I would hope so. But, I mean, the statements which have been made in the past don't sound encouraging.
Is carbon capture research going ahead well in other countries?
I think the negative emission research is just at the cusp, and it's just starting, and it's not very well positioned. And this is a part of the reason why we had such a large response by so many people to the Kevin Anderson paper, because you get in trouble with both sides, right? If you think climate change is a hoax, why in the world would you want negative emissions, right? And if on the other side, people who say you need to do the purest thing and stop all fossil fuel consumption overnight, and you need to change your lifestyle, and that's the only way to solve the problem, and negative emissions give you an excuse not to do that, therefore it shouldn't be done, you are caught in the middle. The problem is we have had by now 20 years to implement mitigation without negative emissions, and we have done practically nothing, right? And in 1980, we could have had a very good discussion about whether we should or should not have negative emissions because it might delay implementation. But by now, we are so far down the road that I don't think we can make it happen without negative emissions.
I think there's a communications problem, too, because people seem to be nervous about using a technology to solve the problems of technology. How can we solve that?
Well, the alternative is not to use technology. And people seem to take energy so much for granted that they don't realize that they rely on it every day. We wouldn't be able to feed people unless we had the amount of energy we had. Which is not to say that on occasion we don't waste it, right? But we have fertilizer, and without fertilizer, we couldn't feed 7 billion people. And guess what? When we make fertilizer, we first make hydrogen to make ammonia. And making that hydrogen took energy. And if you want clean water, you have to clean up water, and that requires energy. If you want raw materials, you need energy. If you want to fly from New York to Los Angeles, you need energy. If you want to have a radio system, you are consuming energy. We are consuming energy without thinking about it day in and day out. And it's not all that easy to turn this off overnight. And as a matter of fact, we can't stop using energy. What we might be able to do is change the energy infrastructure into one which doesn't produce CO2. But even that is not all that easy. People say there's a risk in relying on negative emissions like direct air capture because it's not proven. But it's also not proven that we have an energy storage system that can live with the intermittency of sunshine and wind, right? And most people are objecting to nuclear energy too. So we don't really have good answers yet, and we need to work on hard to get them. And to me, you need to look at all of these aspects, and you probably need all of the above, because no single part of this has the solution by itself. And I think it's very counterproductive to say we don't want the help of this side because we don't like this particular approach to it. This cannot be a zero-sum game, right? Because if it is a zero-sum game, we have lost.
Well, looking forward with your own work at the University of Arizona Center for Negative Carbon Emissions, what's next?
Well, one of the things I'm working on very hard is direct air capture because I think it's pivotal and central. Right? If you have the ability to pull CO2 back out of the air at an affordable price, then you can do several things. You can take that CO2 and you can dispose of it. So that's the waste disposal aspect. And in that sense, I would argue we are the sweeper, the street sweeper, which takes the CO2, which already littered the atmosphere, and take it back. But we can also close the carbon cycle together with renewable energy. and observed that liquid carbon-based fuels are actually extremely good at carrying energy in the transportation sector. And nothing really prevents you from making those from CO2 and water and renewable energy, right? So we could make gasoline or methanol or whatever fuel you choose, provided we have energy, which can split water into hydrogen and oxygen and CO2 into CO and oxygen. And the CO and hydrogen we can convert into fuels. And we know how to do this since the 1920s. And Fischer-Tropsch is just one example. The Fischer-Tropsch process is just one example of how to do that. So we can close the carbon cycle that way. And right now this cannot compete because it's more expensive than taking petroleum. But in a world where you have to bury the CO2 from the petroleum, you may very well find that this option is cheaper. Not to mention, it gives an enormous bonus to or benefit to renewable energy because these are by nature intermittent, and making fuels out of it can be a flexible consumer, right? You can turn it on whenever there is too much electricity and turn it off when there is not enough. And by the way, if there is really not enough, you can consume some of that fuel to make the electricity which is needed right here and now. So a classic example is Denmark, which is relying more and more on wind, and it more and more needs an energy storage system that can take some of the energy when there is lots of wind, and it can sell that in principle into the transportation sector where you use fuel. So in this case, we are not trying to create negative emissions, but closing the carbon cycle. But if you think of this problem as a waste management problem, in the parlance of waste management, this is reduce, reuse, recycle, right? We just figured out how to be more efficient. We got away from using fossil carbon, and we recycled the carbon through the system over and over and over again. But whenever you dump CO2 into the atmosphere, you are obligated to take it back out. And right now, I don't really know how to fly an airplane without producing CO2.
Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, we talked so animatedly, I'm not entirely sure. let me think about it. I did talk about the waste management analogy. I did talk about a certificate of carbon sequestration. I think ultimately we have proven that it's very, very hard to come up with a top-down solution. So I'm getting more and more to the point where I think it has to be from the bottom up. So imagine a world where you can push a button on the pump where you get your gasoline and you ask for the CO2 you just create to be taken back. Most people don't realize it, but every gallon of gasoline you burn in your car puts 20 pounds of CO2 into the atmosphere. So if you get the price of air capture down to, let's say, $30 a ton, you would have to spend a quarter or more on the gallon of gasoline, and you would have balanced your book. That is also the additional cost if the fuel was made from renewable energy, plus the electricity cost which went into it. It's not the air capture cost, ultimately, which gets you. Now, can we get to $30 a ton? It's very hard to say. At the first time around, people did it with a brute force approach. They were at $600 a ton, so this would add a little more than $5 to the gallon of gasoline, and that clearly feels too expensive. And people back then said, this is hopeless. But on the other hand, photovoltaic today is 100 times cheaper than it was in the 1960s. So once you start working down this learning curve, things will get cheaper. And if you look at the startups, carbon engineering, global thermostat, the technologies we do here in a university environment, we are clearly a lot cheaper than this first one because we all have a much simpler process. Right. So we all think we are probably between $100 and $200 a ton. And one of them in the group, Global Thermostat, actually thinks they are even well below that, around $50 a ton. But the proof is in the pudding. Right. But that means you need somebody who actually takes it off on the other side. And so you need volunteers who help you start.
We've been talking with Dr. Klaus Lackner, a leading scientist in the search for a way to rebalance greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And I'll put links to the papers we've discussed, including Dr. Lackner's letter to the journal Science,
as published on November 11th. I'll put all of that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Klaus Lackner, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time and your insight with us.
You're very welcome. And as you put it up there, please notice there are 44 other people signing the letter.
I will do that, and I'll put that in my blog as well. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We covered so much in this show. I'll put links for you to follow up and check our guests in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Yes, I know the blog is way too long. I hope you can scan through to find the links you need. Please take time to explore. There's everything at stake. In these times of denial, it's my honor to represent you at the sources of science and reality. Thank you for listening and for caring about our world.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and today we're going to be talking to the former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, who was a good friend of Fidel Castro's and someone who lived through all the great historical moments that many of us are familiar with. We want to commemorate, of course, the life of the great anti-imperialist fighter, the great socialist fighter, builder of a great movement in Cuba, one who inspired the world. And we know that because the Globe and Mail is unhappy about him and the Toronto Star is unhappy about him. And even Mulcair can't bring himself to make sense. So that is proof of Fidel's accomplishments, because the little Anglo narrow group is hovering around and is making a circle, as they always do, pulling the wagons together, trying to dictate to the world. It ain't going to work, but that's what they're trying to do. At 5:30, we'll be talking to Professor Isaac Saney in Dalhousie University. He's written one of the great books about the Cuban Revolution, and it is called Revolution on the Move. I'm not looking at my notes, but that's an approximate. Of course, we're going to say something along the way about the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is an American struggle and tragedy, and many people are rallying to the native people who are demonstrating there, and they are now – it's getting into an ugly stage. It is getting colder, and the army is coming. So this is – anybody knows the story of the great Sioux Nation, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, has a rough idea of what is going to occur. So those would be the main items. By the way, Phil Conlon is here. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And how are you doing?
Well, I'm like everybody else. I'm thinking about Fidel, and he's been part of my life since I was like, I think, 13 years old. So, it's just a moment to think about his tremendous accomplishments, and
indeed,
watching the world react, and it divides the phonies from the real people. Have to say,
it's heartening. Yeah. It's very heartening. Yeah.
Evidently Prince Harry was forced to stand at attention when the Governor General of St. Vincent at an event said, let's all bow our heads for a moment of silence for Fidel Castro, who was my good friend and a good friend of the people of St. Vincent, and mm-hmm. the British press is going nuts. It was an insult to the royal family and all that sort of stuff.
Well, that's encouraging. I think we're joined now by the former Attorney General of the United States, Mr. Ramsey Clark. Are you there, sir?
I am, Phil. How are you?
Very good, and we're very glad to be talking to you today, Ramsey, because, of course, you lived through all these so many of the great moments that we know from the life and activity of Fidel Castro, who has passed away at the age of 90. I should tell our listeners, you were a member of, I think, both administrations. You were a member of the Kennedy administration. You were also you, of course, became Attorney General under Lyndon Johnson. And by the way, every American and everybody around the world should take their hats off to you as the one who guided the Civil Rights Act for America, guaranteeing the right to vote for black Americans, which is, of course, it's still in endangered condition. But living through all of that, I'd like to know, what are your thoughts about Fidel and what you think about that people should have in their memories or know about him?
Well, I think he was one of the great leaders of the second half of the 20th century and into this one. I had the good fortune to know him over a period of, I can't count right now, but over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And he was courageous in the face of adversity by a pretty powerful government to the north that didn't like him for most of the years, if not all. Of course, there are elements of the government that liked him, but I can't say that I'm aware of one of the presidents or secretary of states that really favored the Castro years of Cuba. Mm-hmm. But they were great years, and they came at a time of great repression and concentration of wealth with widespread poverty. And they were for a true revolution, it's overthrowing a very powerful and vengeful regime. They were nonviolent, and they spread knowledge and goodwill extensively through Latin America and Africa. It's amazing how that little country would send, they had a tremendous medical educational system down there, and they send highly skilled doctors into very poor countries throughout Latin America and throughout Western Africa particularly, but also into East Africa. Ask for nothing except to be permitted to serve people who needed health care, including countries that were desperately ignorant of health care and vast malnutrition and rampages of various diseases.
Yeah, they got into the – they were the first to arrive with real doctors in numbers for the Ebola crisis, when others were afraid.
They seemed to pay no attention to the risk for the doctors. The doctors themselves and medical assistants that went in with them. But they saved, who knows, millions of lives. Their medical people saw more people who had never seen a doctor before, or after probably. Mm-hmm. And I'd say any country in the world. I don't know what country would have sent more doctors to more countries to treat people who'd never seen a doctor than little Cuba, under the inspiration and guidance of Fidel Castro.
And he was such
pretty amazing story, and it's not known. In fact, it's resisted by Western countries, particularly the United States.
Yeah, it's such a ugly, fateful development that the U.S. has placed itself against everyone, right? On the issue of embargo and blockade and the sanctions, the United Nations General Assembly, as far as I know, is practically unanimous. And from the beginning saying, don't do that. And the U.S. cannot bring itself to stop being ignorant and a bully.
Well, most U.S. administrations pay no attention to advice from the U.N. They just insist on the U.N. following its advice or command, which is harsh, but significantly true.
Yeah. By the way, don't you think that... To me, it's a miracle that they were able, in the face of the collapse of the Soviet Union and utter hostility and diktat from the United States, they actually survived that. And he did. Amazing.
Yeah, and that's only the, in a way, that's only the lesser part of the story. Because at the same time, I'll tell you, there are more people on Earth that saw foreign doctors for treatment. It had never had exposure to a doctor from Cuba, and probably from the rest of the world combined, certainly from any single country or any several combination of countries. They sent doctors everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
That is, everywhere that couldn't provide adequate health care for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There are more people in the poor countries of the world that saw a Cuban doctor as the first doctor they ever saw.
And it's just, you can see why people are so moved around the world, except in Washington and London and Paris.
It wasn't a for-profit business, you know. Isn't that amazing? And they loved it. The doctor, I don't know if you ever saw any of those teams up in the mountains of Guatemala or any place else. I saw them in Southern Africa, and not South Africa, but Southern Africa, and
We're speaking
Central America, and all over the globe.
Yeah, we're speaking to Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States, and the founder of the International Action Center. By the way, I would urge people to go to that site. There's a good statement on Fidel, and also there's many urgent issues such as Mumia Jamal and Leonard Peltier and Standing Rock being discussed there. And these are all matters, by the way, that Fidel cared about. I want to make sure I ask you, Ramsey, because you are one of the witnesses to a decision by Fidel to assist Angola in fighting apartheid South Africa when they invaded that country. You actually went there. Can you tell us something about that experience? You went there with Sean McBride, the winner of the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, I did. Sean shouldn't have gone because he was not well, and he couldn't travel when we got there. But his presence in the capital was inspiring and worth the effort he shouldn't have made.
Mm-hmm.
We went down. There was a chain of armored vehicles coming up through central Angola towards some rugged hills. You wouldn't call them mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And Cuba provided some extended range artillery. You know, South Africa had a sophisticated not only well armed but advanced weaponry. People love to from the United States and Western Europe to support him because they were repressing the Lord's poor on the planet in their areas. And we got down there in less than 48 hours before this sophisticatedly armed military caravan from South Africa was coming up a long road, and it was a huge country. Mm-hmm. And they had probably 700, 800 miles at least from their entry point in the southwest of the country on up toward the capital, which is on the northeast side of the country. And there's some hills where they mounted some extended range. They had extended range artillery could fire 18, 19 miles with some accuracy. They could hit the road or near the road. And South Africa had a sophisticatedly armed column of trucks. It was soil that you, if you got off the road, you might be in trouble because of the weight of the vehicle would be greater than the overburden that was there, and you get stuck in the sand, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And this extended range artillery knocked out the leading vehicles in the column. It was fascinating to talk to the young soldiers from South Africa. They didn't want to be there. They didn't want to come there. They didn't want to go home. In part, they didn't want to go home. Now, they love their home, of course, and their family, but they were like many young South Africans I met before that had left because they couldn't stand apartheid. But they were afraid, too, that after their, from a military standpoint, disgraceful defeat because they couldn't defend themselves against this extended range artillery. They had sophisticated weapons, but they didn't have long distance artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And they were stopped in their tracks, and they were the most. I've seen a lot of soldiers in a number of places in large numbers after a defeat that had been captured, and these guys. They were the happiest captives I ever saw. They didn't want to go home. They're all white, of course. South Africa couldn't trust young men from the majority of the population to arm them because of the racism and repression of the real Africans, the black Africans.
So Fidel's decision in Cuba saved Angola and contributed to the defeat of apartheid in that moment.
Yeah, and that's among many things that he did. But the that artillery would fire with accuracy about 16, 17 miles,
mm-hmm.
and the column that was coming up was armored primarily, didn't have extended range artillery with it. I think they'd have brought that up later if they had to. If they got stuck before they got to Luanda or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But so they were just sitting ducks down there in the dairy. There wasn't even a bush you could hide behind. It was desert. I never saw such happy prisoners of war. They really were. These young guys were thinking, free at last.
Yeah, glad to be a prisoner.
Many of them went home. Yeah, I suppose some of them went back to their families later on. But
yeah.
And they weren't, Angola had no interest in either keeping them or hurting them, but it housed them for quite a while. Some of them didn't want to go home.
Gave them an education, teach them some respect for Africans, and certainly for the Cuban revolution.
The Cubans saved them, but the Angolan government was very wise and liberal and constructive and
well,
forward-looking government.
I want to get your comment on this. Today in Aleppo, the Syrian government is finally having, looks like in the final stages, the defeating terrorists who are sponsored by the United States, Saudi Arabia, and others trying to overthrow that their government. And people, I don't know if everybody knows, but the Cubans under Fidel Castro, of course, were in solidarity, a complete solidarity with the Syrian people in their fight for self-determination and sovereignty.
Of course, they are. They defended freedom under attack, you know, wherever it showed its ugly head, and or repression of people wherever it showed its ugly head. There was a military struggle, and the people, the government was prevailing, and until Cuba came in.
Mm-hmm.
But that southwest corner of the country was, you could hear artillery fire coming in from Lebanon to the southwest corner for a year before assistance came, and they finally turned the war around. And the effort to overthrow the Syrian government from outside was enormous.
That's right. That is not the first. I'm really glad you remind us of that. Lastly, and I know I'm taking advantage of you, I don't like to use up your time, but if you could just tell us, you did have some encounters, good discussions with Fidel. Give us your impression of him as an individual.
Well, he was his mind was omnivorous for information. He wanted to know everything, and he worked hard in the daytime, but he apparently didn't sleep at night. Not much, because he would go in there with three or four people, and usually one of them or two would catch his interest or attention, and he would be pumping them for information. Most heads of state, they want to tell you something. You know, this head of state, he wanted to learn something, and but he'd keep you up. He particularly liked intellectuals and writers.
Mm-hmm.
We took a number of women writers in over the years, and they really good writers and authors from the United States. And he'd read their books. He was an omnivorous reader.
Wow.
He could debate their books with them better than I could, and I've always read a lot of books. If you've seen walking into this living room, you got to be careful you don't tip over a pile.
Yes, I have a memory of that.
Have an avalanche. So he was, I just hope we'll have biographies that will reveal his entire contribution.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Cuba before the revolution, and the oppression there was, I've been all over the world and spent a lot of time a lot of places, but the repression in Cuba before its revolution, led by Castro, was his great, and the helplessness of the poor people there was his great. And the revolution brought education and health care and universities of a quality that brought top scholars from all over the world, not to teach, but to read in their library and learn with some of the best students around, because of the motivation that was instilled in young people to learn well and study hard.
Hmm.
The revolution there was, it came on top of a form of corruption that's singularly unhealthy, that was partly our fault, because as a vacation place, you could have all kinds of sinful good times down there. And we inspired that sort of, Cuba was notorious for, you know, prostitution and gambling and everything before Castro. Not only police state control of its own population. And he wasn't entirely a Puritan, but he was sure a moral reformer.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Ramsey, it has been great talking to you, and you validated, really, I think it's the hearts of people all over the world that we've lost a great man. But I think, I assume you agree, that what he left behind is full of energy and probably going to continue on his road.
I think the seed is firmly planted, and it'll grow for some generations at least.
Well, then, Ramsey, thank you very, very much.
Wonderful to hear you, Phil.
Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States. He is the founder of the International Action Center. You can find that online. And today they are featuring, of course, a review of the great accomplishments and impact of Fidel. I love to say just Fidel rather than Fidel Castro. Just have to say Fidel. You know, some people say some rock star's name, but we can say that about – he's a rock star of revolution. They are talking today about Mumia Jamal, who, by the way, is not in good health, and people should go to the sites – there are a number of them – to support Mumia Jamal and get win his freedom and get medical care that he desperately needs. As well, I just want to say again that he Ramsey Clark is the consensus greatest attorney general in modern American history. That's because of the civil rights legislation. What else can you talk about? I mean, America, as we can see, anybody just pick up your newspaper, is steeped in racism and racial discord, and the winning of the right to vote and civil rights. It was called Civil Rights Act, but there were many departments under that. That was the work primarily in the Attorney General's office of Ramsey Clark. So we're very, very proud and pleased that he was with us today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Stephen Rosenfeld, who assesses the rationale behind election recounts in key Midwestern battleground states and the question of legitimacy looming over the 2016 presidential election results. Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas, who examines corporate media's coverage of the 2016 election campaign and concerns about the normalization of hate and lies after President-elect Trump takes office in January, and retired union coal miner Ron Pauley, who talks about the campaign to win congressional passage of the Coal Miners Protection Act that would extend promised health care benefits to retired miners. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For weeks, hundreds of thousands of South Koreans have flooded into the streets of Seoul to demand the resignation of President Park Geun-hye in the largest protests in a generation. In late October, a corruption scandal exploded, which engulfed Park and her key associates. Allegations surfaced suggesting government officials pressured major corporations like Samsung to make multi-million dollar donations to sports groups controlled by Choi Soon-sil, a longtime friend of the president. The scandal forced Park, daughter of former South Korean dictator Park Chung-hee, to apologize and fire top aides who now face criminal charges. President Park is immune from prosecution as long as she remains in office. Park first met the Choi family in the 1970s after her mother was assassinated by a bullet meant for her father. After Choi's father, who ran a Christian sect, claimed that he could contact her dead mother, the two families remained close. A 2007 U.S. State Department cable leaked by WikiLeaks from the embassy staff in Seoul claimed the elder Choi had complete control over Park Geun-hye's body and soul during her formative years, and that his children accumulated enormous wealth as a result. The opposition is now gearing up for an impeachment drive against Park, who has 14 months left in office. 2 years ago, armed police in Sandpoint, Idaho, killed Native American Janetta Riley. Riley, who was homeless and pregnant with a history of mental illness, refused to drop a knife before she was shot by police. Only moments earlier, her husband had sought aid at a local hospital, fearing Riley would commit suicide. According to the news magazine In These Times, Riley, a descendant of the Suquamish tribe, joins a long list of Native Americans killed in confrontations with police. Between May 2014 and November 2015, 29 Native Americans were killed by police across the United States, yet only one incident gained sustained media coverage. That case involved a Rosebud Sioux man named Paul Castaway, who was killed by police in Denver as he attempted to commit suicide. In Minneapolis, local reporters largely ignored the police killing of a White Earth Ojibwe man, Philip Quinn, while in contrast, local media provided extensive coverage to a slain black man, Jamar Clark. Both men were killed in the fall of 2015, 1 year after the police killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. The media has also largely ignored decades of discrimination against Native peoples in New Mexico and South Dakota. Many of America's poorest workers toil in America's massive food chain, which includes farm workers, laborers in food processing plants, supermarket workers, and restaurant staff. Despite recent job growth within the food industry, which now employs more people than work in the U.S. manufacturing sector, wages remain stagnant with few benefits. The average wage for workers in the food sector is just $10 an hour, with incomes of only $16,000 per year. According to a new study, No Piece of the Pie, by the Food Chain Workers Alliance and Solidarity Research Collaborative, over 21 million people work in the food chain. Not only does the average job pay poorly, but these workers are more likely to rely on food stamps and other public assistance than in any other industry in the American economy. These harsh conditions persist even with the emergence of new movements pushing to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. The average employee in the food industry earns over $7 an hour less than other U.S. workers. Even when compared with the construction sector, which attracts many immigrant workers, wages are much lower in agriculture and restaurants. Moreover, union representation rates among workers in food processing, distribution, and retail has fallen sharply over the last 20 years. Today, food system CEOs enjoy an annual median wage of $120,000 a year, making about six times that of a frontline worker. For every dollar earned by a food CEO, an average worker brings home only 17 cents. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein has captured national attention in this anxious post-election period by calling for recounts in the battleground states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Despite Stein's own view that the recounts won't likely change the election outcome, the two-time Green Party standard bearer says she's launched the recount drive to draw attention to serious questions that have emerged about the integrity of the nation's voting system after allegations that Russia had hacked Democratic Party emails and concern about the security of older electronic voting machines. While Donald Trump won the election based on the archaic Electoral College vote allocation, he lost the popular vote by more than 2 million ballots. Although Hillary Clinton had not requested a recount, her campaign decided to take part in the effort, as they said, to ensure that it's fair to all sides. Thus far, the Green Party has raised more than $6 million that will help pay for the recounts in the three states. The Wisconsin Elections Commission agreed to begin a recount of the presidential election on December 1st, but was sued by Stein after the agency declined to require county officials to recount the votes by hand. Stein has also filed a lawsuit in Pennsylvania to force a recount there and plans to formally request a recount in Michigan on November 30th. If a state begins the process of an official recount and doesn't complete it by the federal deadline of December 13th, they run the risk of not having their electoral votes count. Your reporter spoke with Stephen Rosenfeld, who covers national political issues for Alternet. Here he assesses the rationale behind the election recounts and the question of legitimacy looming over the 2016 presidential election results.
The Greens are really committed to this notion of verifying the vote, and that they believe that by casting the spotlight on the different voting systems and the procedures, and they're not the same, and it gets sort of stuck in the different silos and in the weeds a little bit, in these three different states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, that they're really going to show people how rickety the voting system is, how unreliable the counting is, how imprecise it is, how hard it is to actually walk away with confidence. And now some states will be better than others, and this is the way it is across the country. Some states are better than others. So they're doing it for that reason, and, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen. It may very well be that they will – it's only 11,000 votes in Michigan – that they might change a result there. But, you know, this is like changing or winning three Floridas. You have to win all three to reverse the presidential election. So that's what's so very unlikely.
Steve, in doing these vote recounts, what is going to be the focus? Is it looking for electronic voting machine flaws in the vote count, accidental or deliberate? And or is it hacking of the vote by political operatives inside the U.S. or has been suggested by some the vote being skewed by outside operatives like the nation of Russia?
The purpose of a recount is to verify the vote. Now, you have different ways that people vote in different states. And it's not just voting by mail or voting in polling places. There's different kinds of machinery in polling places. In some places, you take a pen and you mark a paper ballot, and the paper ballot gets scanned. In Michigan, for example, there was something like 80,000 to 90,000 ballots that were scanned that didn't register a presidential vote. There were only 11,000 votes separating Clinton and Trump. You know, the Michigan state election officials are very defensive about that. They say nothing is wrong, but, you know, this becomes an example of many examples of, well, let's take a look. Why does it hurt? You know, verify. Don't take anybody's word. Then, in other states, you have other aspects of the voting systems that raise different questions. So, in Wisconsin, for example, people noticed that in the counties that primarily use the paperless machines, Donald Trump's margin of victory was between 10 and 15%, the largest in the states. And in the counties that relied mostly on paper ballots, Hillary Clinton won. They also see in some of these counties where there was supposedly this great rural upsurgence of non-college graduate white voters, that the turnout was 85, 90%. You know, they want to go into these towns where there are several hundred people, and if they can find a dozen or two dozen people who said, I'm not going to vote, I don't care, those guys do nothing for me, then all of a sudden it looks like the turnout numbers are not right, and you move to the next set of questions, which is, well, what happened? Did an electronic machine not run right? Did somebody tinker with the results? And that's when you get the whole arc of conspiracy theories. What you have here is a series of dots that it's going to be very hard to connect.
You've written a book about counting the votes. From your perspective, what do we have to do to clean up the mess of both the machinery of elections in the United States, as well as the hodgepodge of different laws state by state, many of which, since the demise of the Voting Rights Act, courtesy of the Supreme Court, we've seen a lot of voter suppression laws go into place in Republican-controlled states. What's the essential job here from this date forward, where we have to repair our electoral system?
Well, the essential job is to simplify the process of making voter registration easier and almost universal. And some states are actually doing that. The barriers to entry, whether it's registration or getting a ballot on a polling place, they should just be lowered. And in many places, they're not lowered. And that's what all the voter registration, voter suppression, you know, all that sort of partisan tinkering with the rules comes from. And on the vote counting side, as old-fashioned as this sounds, you really need to use paper ballots so that there can be recounts. Anything else leaves you with the guessing game that we're going to be reading about in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin.
That was journalist Steven Rosenfeld, who writes for Alternate.org and is author of the book Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting. Find his recent articles on the 2016 election recount by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From the moment Donald Trump launched his presidential candidacy in the Republican Party primary, it was clear that the real estate billionaire and reality TV star was not just another ordinary politician. His denunciations of Mexicans, Muslims, and raw expressions of misogyny disregarded the standard GOP dog whistle-style bigotry that's been part of the party for decades. Instead, Trump's incendiary hate speech, linked with the scapegoating of minorities, succeeded in galvanizing his support among white men who were eager to identify those to blame for the decline of America's middle class and their standard of living. Although the right-wing populism with bogus bumper sticker-like policy solutions helped Trump win the GOP nomination in the Electoral College vote, most Americans saw through the scam and voted against him. At the outset of the campaign, major corporate media outlets provided billions of dollars of free airtime to Trump, owing to the public's fascination with his circus sideshow persona and the profits high ratings brought in. But even as the November election drew closer, the nation's major newspapers and TV networks accorded Trump's extremist rhetoric a false equivalency to that of his Democratic opponent Hillary Clinton. This normalization of Trump's hate-filled views continued after he won the election, when former head of Breitbart News and campaign CEO Steve Bannon was appointed as Trump's chief White House strategist. The Washington Post didn't describe him as the promoter of vicious racism, misogyny, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism, which he was. Instead, the Capitol's paper of record benignly described him as a hard-charging strategist who does not shy away from the rigors of a tough campaign. Your reporter spoke with Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, who examines corporate media's coverage of the 2016 election campaign and concerns about the normalization of hate and lies after President-elect Trump takes office in January.
The worst performances in journalism within the mainstream, the corporate commercial press, call it what you like, are really the television stations. They're the place most people go for news, and they're the place where people get the least news and the least important news and often the most distorted news. So we know how to make a critique of Fox Media. It's ideologically open about its right-wing perspective. But I'm talking here not so much about Fox, but about CNN. You know, there've been several news executives quoted saying some version of this, that Trump is bad for democracy, great for the ratings, and therefore great for the bottom line. And it's one of those times when you see the crass profit motive of corporate media come to the fore most directly. And so that's a critique specifically of television. And I think television is kind of at the heart of the rot in a lot of ways. You know, as Noam Chomsky's been pointing out for a couple of years now, the Republican Party is not any longer a traditional parliamentary party in the sense that it's interesting in governing and in working through the typical legislative and executive functions. It's really a bizarre combination of elements that, you know, include conservative Christians and libertarian Republicans and the standard corporate class and a Tea Party movement that is often overtly racist, disaffected working class people who used to vote Democrat. I mean, it's a weird mix. And I don't think that the mainstream media on any front, whether it's television or newspapers, have done a very good job of explaining the modern Republican Party, of which Trump is an outgrowth.
Robert Jensen, in what ways has the media normalized the racism, xenophobia, and misogyny that was certainly a primary feature of the Trump campaign through both the primary campaign as well as the general election campaign?
Yeah. Well, this is where we see the traditional norm of objectivity begin to fall apart, that, you know, if you're going to quote Democrats saying Trump is racist and then quote Trump and other Republicans saying, no, we're not racist, it's to miss the point that it's not a question of whether Donald Trump is overtly racist in the form of the Klan. He certainly said things that lead to that conclusion at times. But more importantly was his ability to mobilize a very, I was going to say latent, but I don't even think it was fair to call it a latent white nationalist racism. Because in polite circles, that kind of racism is unacceptable. It's been in the fore of American politics now for the last 8 years. Ever since Barack Obama was elected, there was a space in mainstream political discourse for an overt racism that we hadn't seen in a long time.
Robert, what are your concerns going forward with the corporate media and the ways in which they may treat the incoming Trump regime in terms of really letting Trump and his associates in the administration off the hook for some views which are really on the fringe of American political discourse? And by that, I mean extremist, racist, xenophobic.
Yeah, I think you're right, because for all the political debates about issues in a free society where we sort of start with the idea that everything's up for debate, there have to be some things that are no longer in a sense debatable. And one of them is the inherent humanity and equality of all people. And when you have people on the fringes now moving toward the center who want to, in a sense, relitigate the civil rights movement, well, I think it's fair to say that that's outside the bounds of acceptable discourse. But before we even get to how they're going to deal with those kind of complex questions, let's look at just what's happened since the election. And there are two really important things that I found very disturbing. One was that a number of news media leaders, and this were some of the anchors from both network and cable news, as well as editors and news managers, they agreed to a private off-the-record meeting with Donald Trump. Now, I don't know under what conception of journalism you would agree to an off-the-record meeting with a president-elect who has spent the entire campaign attacking you and attacking the concept of freedom of expression in some sense, and certainly attacking the concept of rationality, which Donald Trump's life is an attack on rationality. That was the first indication that the news media is not even capable of understanding what they're dealing with. The second was the New York Times meeting with Donald Trump. So as you may know, the New York Times staff, the publisher, the editor, and a number of columnists and reporters sat down for a on-the-record interview with Donald Trump. The transcript of it is on the New York Times website. And it's chilling to read it, not only because Trump is still Trump, but because the New York Times staff, they're so solicitous of this guy. There's the New York Times staff, up to and including the publisher, yucking it up with this guy. They're treating him again like he's a statesman of some sort. You know, that is not the appropriate response of a news organization to a politician in general, but certainly not to one as bizarre as Donald Trump. Again, someone who has both attacked journalists and someone who has routinely said that he doesn't really care about the facts. He doesn't really care about reason. It may sound a bit hyperbolic, but I literally found it a chilling read, and it doesn't bode well.
That was Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, author of the forthcoming book titled The End of Patriarchy,
Radical Feminism for Men. Find links to Jensen's articles and related media analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A New York Times editorial on November 28th scolded Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky for his refusal to support legislation called the Miners Protection Act. In the wake of major shifts in the coal industry and many bankruptcies, coal companies have in many cases been released from their obligation to guarantee cradle-to-grave health care for their union employees. Those benefits were won in 1946. Through negotiations between then-President Harry Truman and the powerful President of the United Mine Workers of America at the time, John L. Lewis. The proposed legislation would shore up United Mine Workers of America pension and health benefits programs that are now headed toward insolvency, because fewer coal companies pay into the programs that at the same time have seen a growth in the numbers of beneficiaries. The program would be funded not through tax dollars, but through some of the interest that's accrued on the more than $3 billion in the government's abandoned mine land fund. On a trip to West Virginia last August, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus met Ron Pauley, who worked almost 34 years in underground and surface mines and in coal prep plants. Tuhus reached him by phone to discuss the status of the bill, how the legislation would benefit miners, and the current campaign to gain congressional passage. He also comments on the dubious promises of President-elect Donald Trump to revive the U.S. coal industry.
One thing on this legislation, the Miners Protection Act, that's so important to me and more important to other people's is it's our insurance, our prescription drugs. You take some of the retirees that draw a small pension during the year, it might be $700 a month, $800 a month. This will cripple them if they have to go out and buy insurance. They've worked all their life, been promised cradle-to-grave health care since 1946 by the sitting president then. And we've worked for lower wages, lower benefits than other people because we were on the presumption that we would have health care from cradle to grave. It's not a appropriation of money or any money to the taxpayer. It's coming from abandoned coal mine act, which has $3 billion in it. We just want to use some of the interest money out, and that's coal company money. It's not costing the taxpayer 1 cent, but you're looking upwards of 100,000 coal miners, widows, and dependents that's going to lose their health care.
I know that you and other miners have been to Washington many times to talk to members of Congress about the Miners Protection Act. For some reason, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the majority leader, hasn't come out in support.
Mr. McConnell's comments about it just covering union miners and non-union miners. You look at dollar per hour, they paid their non-union miners more. They never was promised nothing. They had insurance while they worked. Never was promised health care, what the union miners were. And it's been in every contract since then that we have cradle-grade health care. I think that Mr. McConnell, he has union coal mines down in his areas, a lot of retirees in his district, and not only would this help the miner, it would also help the union coal companies get rid of this liability and be more competitive with the non-union companies. But I'm for give this to the union miner, which was promised this, and then after this is done, and even our senator here in West Virginia, Senator Manchin has said publicly that he would be willing to sit down with Mr. McConnell and others and work on a bill or something to cover the non-union miners.
Senator McConnell has retired union miners in his state. Do you have any idea why he wouldn't support this bill?
My personal opinion on this, and I don't have the written facts to back it up, just my personal opinion is he has one of the biggest non-union mines in his district right there, close to him, and it's Alliance Coal, and they're putting the pressure on him. They want the same thing we get.
Ron Pauley, West Virginia went big for Donald Trump on Election Day. What do you think about his promise to bring coal jobs back and pump up the coal industry?
Myself, personally, I'm not that confident that President-elect Trump will be able to bring the coal industry back because of the price of it. These mines opening up be dictated by price. Right now, the price of coal is low, and they're not going to mine coal for $52, $55 and turn around and sell for $41, $44. It's not going to happen.
That was Ron Pauley, a retired union miner, working for congressional passage of the Miners Protection Act. Learn more about the legislation and some of the major challenges facing coal miners by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
The coming. The time has come. No longer need economic leaders choose political puppets to do their legislative bidding. Today, they simply buy, bribe, or lie their way into political power. The late Eldridge Cleaver, Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party, once said that when fascism comes to America, it won't need a swastika. It'll be singing Yankee Doodle Dandy and waving American flags. What is fascism? The popular political definition is the union of corporations and the state. Because of naked fear and brute ignorance, America has voted for a new political reality. And although it seemed as if the Republican Party was hurtling towards self-destruction, the Democrats lost what initially seemed like a sure thing. The Democratic Party, whose head honchos ensured the fall of the insurgent candidate, Senator Bernie Sanders, may have also ensured failure by opting for yet another Clinton. Remembered now for the ruinous economic impact upon workers because of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA spelled the end for any Clinton victory in labor-heavy precincts like Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Ironically, many of the people who voted for Trump were themselves beneficiaries of the Clinton crime bill, which helped establish dozens of prisons in lightly populated rural areas of Pennsylvania, even becoming the largest employer in some counties. I'd wager that over 90% of prison guards voted not for the family that gave them lifetime jobs, Clinton, but for her nemesis, Donald Trump. Not even the personally popular president, Barack Obama, could carry Hillary Clinton across the finish line, for his coattails did not reach that far. Welcome to the new fascism. Unleashed will be the most racist, vicious, and nationalist forces in the country. That's what America First really means. Guess who's last? New fascism, also known as Trumpism.
from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Class War Gone Wild. One way of looking at American politics is through the lens of class, an area that is generally regarded as impolite, a subject that good people don't discuss. Yet because it's rarely confronted, it lay on the floor like a hand grenade, ready for the hand to grasp it, pull its pin, and toss it into the midst of the 2016 elections. Donald Trump, a self-proclaimed billionaire, used his little hands to grab it, pull it, and let it fly. The Clinton campaign never saw it coming, and it blew them to bits. That's because neoliberalism is a creature of market-central politics, which treats voters as if they're more concerned about the play of politics rather than the real-life impacts of their economic policies. The defection of millions of white working-class voters from the Democratic machine can be summed up in one acronym, NAFTA. The Clintons, as lawyers, governor, senator, and president, typified the political managerial class, and as such, NAFTA, or its globalizing effects, had no decisive impact on them or their class. But for employees of car manufacturers, of refrigerators, televisions, cabinets, textiles, and tennis shoes, the loss of many manufacturing jobs hit hard and bit deep. There's a reason Hillary lost Ohio and Pennsylvania. The media, with its constant reference to college-educated women, also didn't help matters. For do you know what percentage of Americans have college degrees? Perhaps 30%. If you count on college grads, you count out almost 70% of the people, the vast majority. The Trump campaign was built on nostalgia, when America, presumably, was great. It's a return to the 50s. When millions were employed in vast manufacturing concerns. Truth is, that America is gone, and it won't come back again. Capitalism isn't a moral system, and it doesn't exist to pay workers high salaries. It is a machine that funnels wealth to its executives and shareholders. It goes abroad to reap more profits. Thus, we see the expansion of transnational corporations and the program of globalization. Can Trump actually reverse this project? I don't think so. I doubt if the real ruling class will allow it. But get ready for Trump to bum-rush the culture, to try to bully and belittle all that he opposes. Building on the Clinton legacy of mass incarceration, don't be surprised if this mad machinery gets meaner and nastier. Never doubt that the system can get worse. Also, never doubt that white supremacy is America's reset button. It is the glue that holds it together. Only a vast, disciplined movement can push it back. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 2, 2016. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Red River Métis. On this week's program, we mark the passing of El Comandante Fidel Castro Ruz with a special program reviewing his life and the achievements of the revolution he championed. The son of a wealthy landowner and veteran of the Spanish-American War of 1898, Fidel Castro, the fifth of nine children, benefited from a Jesuit education and eventually studied law at Havana University. During the late 1940s, he became politically engaged and active within the New Orthodoxos Party. By 1952, Fulgencio Batista seized power in a coup. Castro began to organize revolutionary activities and on July 26, 1953, launched an armed attack against the Moncada barracks in Santiago. The insurgency was put down and Castro was condemned to a 15-year prison sentence. Released after Batista announced a general amnesty of the prisoners, Castro sought exile in Mexico, where he met Argentine doctor Ernesto Che Guevara. In December of 1956, he and scores of men returned to Cuba in a yacht named the Granma, where they began a 22-month insurgency against Batista, which culminated in the dictator's departure from Havana on December 31, 1958. Castro arrived in Havana on January 8th of 1959 and assumed the role of prime minister in February of that year. He would remain Cuba's head of state for decades, outlasting 11 U.S. presidents. The newly independent country faced momentous challenges, most notably the threats coming from the United States. When efforts to co-opt the young leader proved unsuccessful, Washington, under newly minted President John F. Kennedy, attempted an invasion at the Bay of Pigs. The operation involved opposition forces working in conjunction with the CIA. The plot proved unsuccessful, damaging America's prestige and boosting the popularity of the new Cuban government, painting the revolution with a kind of David and Goliath mystique. A lengthy U.S. embargo would follow, combined with propaganda and even terrorist attacks directed at Cuba, with the assistance of the pro-Batista exile community in Miami, Florida. The USSR forged an alliance with Cuba. The Soviet leader, Khrushchev, authorized the cruise missiles with nuclear warheads be dispatched to the country for defensive purposes. The infamous cruise missile crisis resulted, in which a nuclear war was barely averted. Castro evolved into a symbol of defiance of U.S. imperial hegemony. His death on November 25th was greeted with great mourning and sadness from his countrymen and from downtrodden peoples around the world inspired by his example. However, mainstream media in the last week has been far from kind to the passing of this giant. To discuss the media response, I'm joined by fellow Canadian journalist Leslie Hughes. She's a broadcaster, media critic, speaker, and humorist. She joins us from her home in Winnipeg. Now, Prime Minister Trudeau issued a statement of condolence following Fidel Castro's death. What did you make of the response that he got from within the mainstream and social media?
Well, the statement itself was, it struck me as minimal. It really was just a courteous statement. And it was a big surprise to me to see that it was met with borderline hysteria. The response from the mainstream didn't surprise me quite as much, I think, as social media, because mainstream media has been manipulated by American opinion for decades, and so much so that we scarcely are aware of it. And the social media response was hysterical. It you know what? It was almost a gotcha moment. You're familiar with gotcha journalism,
which was
a big surprise. It was a very black and white response, a binary response to what Trudeau had said. And so what happened was that it became a dysfunctional story, and a dysfunctional story is what the journalism instructors define as a story that doesn't really have a satisfactory shape or resolution. It just sort of hovers over the community, being vaguely poisonous, and then eventually wears itself out. So it was a, journalistically speaking, it was an interesting incident.
Could you maybe outline what you think a responsible news organization should be doing as they approach a story of this magnitude?
Well, you know, it just sounds so self-evident. It's a matter of avoiding opinion where it's not appropriate and establishing fact. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about being in a post-truth era, which largely is meant to apply to politicians feel they're living in a post-truth era, and the masses, I'm putting that in quotations, are in a post-truth era. But I'm afraid that the media, you know, sensing these things and having even isolated and identified it, are taking advantage of that. So that, you know, they're quite able to express opinion that is not backed by fact. So I'm not saying that, you know, it has to be one opinion or the other. Everybody's opinion needs to be respected, but it also needs to encompass the facts. And the tone here, you know, was one which lacked any balance. A lot of the media venues switched immediately to angry about human rights tone. And frequently these are people who don't have much interest in human rights in any case, except in a situation like this. So that anyone who wants to do a critique of their opinion then becomes anti-human rights, and so it oppresses the argument, if you understand what I'm saying. So that the overall tone is one which discourages any real discussion. So in this case, the trick, I think, was for headlines from which so many people cut lines and headlines, so many people get their opinions from those sources, and they needed to be very condensed, but they should have, I think, have said, this is what Castro achieved for Cuba, which is immense, by the way, in many cases, a society that is better than the United States, and this is where he failed. You know, and citing, of course, the sources where possible.
What would you recommend to those of our listeners who may be seeking a more accurate understanding of Castro's death within an important, that broader political context?
Well, the trick is always to try to see the story through the eyes of the people at the center of the story, rather than just the eyes of readers, listeners, viewers, and what happened, what have you. That's the trick, is to try to bring that perspective forward, which seems to me to be a pretty important one. In this case, you know, for millions of people around the world, in Central America, in South America, in Africa, and in India, There a totally different story emerges, because these people see Castro as a liberator, and they see him as a champion of independence, so that all the coverage that we get here is not sympathetic to the view of the people at the center of the story. And if you want to get that, you know, I'm sorry to say, the only way is by independent research. You have to look past the mainstream media. You have to disregard social media, which is, you know, as everyone knows, wholly irresponsible, and do research. And in my case, you know, what I have not experienced in person, I research, in this case, Castro by association, Castro and Mandela, who was a good friend of his, by the way, Castro and Martin Luther King, Castro and economics, Castro and feminism, and look up the topics that interest you, and then try to put the big picture together. It's a lot of work, Michael, and most people aren't willing to do it.
Well, I appreciate your insights, Leslie. I want to thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Michael, anytime.
We've been speaking with Leslie Hughes, Winnipeg-based journalist, broadcaster, and media critic. Eva Golinger is an attorney with nearly two decades of experience in immigration law. She's been a high-level strategic consultant for high-level clients worldwide, including the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. She's the author of six books, including The Chavez Code and Bush versus Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela. She appears as a regular host on RT Spanish and has received awards for her writings and investigations, including the prestigious International Journalism Award in Mexico. Eva Golinger makes her debut on the Global Research News Hour to share some of her insights into Fidel Castro and how he shaped the destiny of Cuba and Latin America. Welcome to the program, Eva Golinger.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start with your personal impressions of the man? I understand you had a chance to meet El Comandante Castro back in 2005. How did that encounter inform your understanding of who he was and how he championed the national cause?
Well, after that, I actually interacted on numerous occasions with him, but certainly that was the first time. I could say that the first time I ever went to Cuba was in 1995. I was about 22 years old. I couldn't have imagined that 10 years later, I would be standing at the side of Fidel Castro and meeting him at 32 years old. Of age myself, but certainly it was a humbling experience. Just months before that specific encounter, I had launched my first book, The Chavez Code, which was the result of research I had done about the U.S.-led coup against Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in 2002. And the book was actually published as well in Cuba and launched there in the book fair, the International Book Fair, in early 2005. And to my surprise, after the day of the launch, when I went back to the place I was staying in Havana, I had received a giant bouquet of flowers and a bottle of perfume from Fidel. So that was sort of my first interaction with him that, you know, it was unbelievable for me that this man with so much history, so much legacy, such an overwhelming presence worldwide, loved, hated, revered, admired, you know, had sent me flowers because I had launched a book at, you know, the age of 32. And months later, I was back in Havana on a trip with Hugo Chavez. He had invited me to accompany him. We had become friends as well as, you know, I was advising him on certain matters. And it was one of the first actual gatherings of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas. At that time, it just was Cuba and Venezuela were members. You know, it later grew to include 11 countries, now has, I think, around between 9 and 11 countries are formal members. But it was a meeting, you know, with these two very prominent, controversial world leaders. And I happened to be in the middle of it. And we walked through parts of Havana Vieja, old Havana, both of them, Fidel and Chavez, just walking through the streets. I mean, it was such an overwhelming and unbelievable experience because, you know, people often see leaders like that, heads of state, you know, controversial assassination threats against them and think, well, they never interact with the people. You know, they're characterized as dictators, as tyrants in a lot of Western media. But here we were strolling the streets of old Havana, waving to people, they're hugging, they're kissing, you know, I mean, as though just two guys and a bunch of other people, of course, around them walking through this beautiful part of the town.
That's virtually unheard of in so-called democracies, never mind.
Well, certainly. I mean, that level of interaction with the people, because we're not talking about anything that was, you know, prearranged in terms of who could interact with them. And of course, there was security. But Cuba is an incredibly safe place. Havana is the safest city I've ever been to in the world in my life. And I've been to a lot. And so it was an amazing experience. And then I had the chance to interact with Fidel. Chavez got a little envious, and I'm just saying that in a really humble way, but came over and in the middle of my conversation with Fidel, when he was talking to me about Luis Posada Carriles, you know, Cuban terrorist who bombed a Cuban airliner in 1976 and has received protection by the U.S. and Venezuela was trying to get him extradited to Venezuela because that's where he had planned the bombing of the airliner. You know, it's a subject for another discussion. But in any case, that was the time. It was 2005, and the extradition request had just been put in. So Fidel wanted to talk to me about that. Me being someone from the United States and having knowledge of those matters, being an attorney. That's what he wanted to discuss. I mean, it was amazing. It wasn't just, you meet this world leader, you reach out, shake their hand, I give him a copy of my book, you have that kind of interaction. No, he wanted to have an in-depth discussion at an analytical level. What do you think about this? What do you think they're going to do? He wanted my opinion. He wanted to talk about it. And it was, it was a really interesting discussion. And at the same time, one is sort of looking at, who am I talking to here? This is Fidel Castro. This is this person that has just this enormous amount of history around him. And, being in that place at that time, it was an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. In any case, it was an incredible experience to have gone through with Fidel particularly, but also, being there, Chavez and Fidel shared a very special relationship, and it was a very privileged experience to be in the presence of both of them at that time. And, then the years that followed, we maintained contact. We exchanged text, and he frequently commented on my writings in his reflections. He published a column. Fidel published a column of his reflections on different issues, and often referred to my work. And over the years, I got a few boxes of cigars here and there.
And I was wondering if I could maybe just maybe be a bit of a fly in the wall in some of those conversations, because I know you've done a lot of research in the context of Venezuela and efforts to undermine that government, and your research into some of these foreign policy instruments, USAID and USAID and National Endowment for Democracy and so on. And I'm wondering if you could share insights into the way these agencies operate and how Castro confronted those activities and how they may provide some context for some of the things that have been said about him being, authoritarian and a dictator and whatnot.
Well, certainly from the time of the Cuban Revolution, even though in its beginning stages, Castro had the intention of maintaining a friendly relationship with the United States. Unfortunately, it wasn't the U.S. policy at the time, nor it has been since. And ever since then, the U.S. has been undergoing efforts of regime change in Cuba, and to the extreme where they've tried to assassinate Fidel Castro over 600 times that have been documented with solid evidence. And beyond that, all sorts of different tactics to undermine, the Cuban Revolution, Cuba's political process, to infiltrate Cuban political organizations, to actually construct and build other organizations with the pretense of them being pro-democracy NGOs, when in reality they're funded by these U.S. agencies that in fact were created specifically to pursue those types of strategies with a sort of more acceptable facade as promoting democracy around the world. But the complete creation of National Endowment for Democracy, which is congressionally funded in the United States and overseen by the Department of State, as well as USAID, which was initially created with this humanitarian mission under Kennedy, but evolved rapidly to become yet another facade of and channel of U.S. interference in foreign nations using a pretext of humanitarian assistance. Not to say that sometimes work that USAID has done has not been positive for the countries they've worked in. Certainly there are some things that, one can look at and say, okay, that was obviously something legitimate. But the fact that they've increased actually their work efforts and budgets and strategies under their so-called democracy and governance and reconstruction and transition departments, which are all focused on regime change and then rebuilding, countries in the way that the United States wants them to be, including with governments that will be subordinate to U.S. interests, favorable to U.S. agenda. So over the decades, that's been ongoing in Cuba. Of course, Cuba and the Cuban Revolution took a very different tactic than we've seen in the 21st century in revolutions in Latin America and political transformation processes such as in Venezuela or in Bolivia or Ecuador, where they've done it through democratic process. In the case of Cuba, you know, obviously there was the overthrowing of a dictatorship of Batista. The Cuban Revolution took over initially with a plan of, you know, pursuing their form of democracy. It evolved into their own form of socialism, you know, with different elements of democracy. But one of the key differences is that because of the immense threats, because the fact that Cuba, such a small country, has no, at the time at least, did not have any capable armed forces that could, you know, come up against a country like the United States and its immense military power, doesn't have nuclear weapons or anything of the sort, missiles, like, you know, anything that could have engaged in a direct classic warfare with the United States. You know, Cuba had to basically shut down and say, you're out. We don't want to have any presence here of any disrupting force or element. And so the agencies that began working, like NED or USAID, had to do so outside of Cuba, whereas they've pursued those tactics inside countries like Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and many others around the world. But the difference with Cuba is that they formed a lot of the organizations that they fund through U.S. government agencies in the Cuban exile community in Miami. And so those were the ones that initially began the work. And then that evolved, you know, as there was entryway into Cuba physically, they began forming groups and funding, you know, anti-government activists actually on the island. And, you know, it got to the point where some of the documents, some has not been through my particular investigation, but others who do similar work, you know, who uncovered that silly text messaging program, Sunsunio, where the USAID funded with millions of dollars a program to try to influence young Cubans in Cuba through a text messaging service that, you know, drew them in through entertainment and sports, but then was injecting political messages in the hopes of building an anti-government movement that would overthrow the Castro government, you know, things like that. And that type of work has continued. And they've, you know, tried to do that through media. Of course, we know all about the media efforts to interfere in the island and project and transmit, you know, anti-Castro and anti-Cuban revolution propaganda. But, you know, some of that has increased throughout the past couple of decades, and more so in the past 15 years since there have been other changes in Latin America and the rise of other leftist governments, very pro-Cuba, and, you know, that have helped to sort of push forward and maintain the Cuban revolution through difficult economic times. Certainly the U.S. government has continued injecting over $20 million a year through these agencies such as USAID and NED to try to continue to build anti-government groups inside Cuba and outside Cuba that are capable of interfering internally in the Cuban political process.
I know I've only got time for one more question because I know you got to go soon, but I wanted you to comment, if you could, on, like, there's a recent thawing in relations under Obama. However, President-elect Trump has threatened to reimpose sanctions, and you've heard the sorts of things he's had to say about him and his vice president, Mike Pence, calling him a tyrant and so on. So I just wanted to get your thoughts about what the death of Castro and the arrival of the Trump administration will mean for the future of Cuba.
Well, certainly the passing of Fidel Castro was to be expected, 90 years old. I mean, he went out victoriously because they tried to kill him so many times. You know, all the speculation around how Fidel Castro would exit from this planet officially was wrong. He proved them wrong at every stage. You know, they thought he'd rule forever till his death. You know, he stepped down voluntarily and throughout the years since has become more of sort of an intellectual presence, as well as always maintaining that sort of figurehead as the comandante of the Cuban Revolution. But in these past couple years since the thawing in relations between the two governments, U.S. and Cuba, as pursued by Raul Castro and Barack Obama, Fidel maintained his very accurate, and I agreed with, position of being cautious. and wary of U.S. intentions, because as positive as the steps were that Obama helped push forward inside the United States, and they certainly have been, and he's done pretty much as much as he could, considering the restraints in Congress that they're the final entity that has to lift the blockade against Cuba. But Obama has done a lot of other stuff that's been very valuable for improving the relationship beyond just the diplomatic ties and the release of the remaining Cuban five. But, you know, we have to be realistic about this. Cuba has always been open to having a better relationship. They don't want another government coming in to tell them what to do. So that's the bottom line here. And if Trump is going to roll back everything Obama has done so far, which a lot of that he can do, he'll come up against a lot of opposition internally in the United States. Will that have any impact on Cuba? Absolutely not. I mean, it's, you know, this is the Cuban government, the Cuban Revolution has been battling U.S. aggression for over half a century. They know exactly what they're dealing with. They have no pretense of expecting anything from the United States. It's not as though they've opened up their doors and said, oh, come on in and do whatever you want. And now when Trump gets into office, which still we hope won't happen, but when he does, you know, and tries to do things, Cuba's not just going to sit there and let it happen. So, you know, they will take a more radical stance. A lot of people were deceived by Trump and fell trapped to his – he's a con man. And he sold, you know, to the people who voted for him a whole idea that he was some kind of radical change maker, which is absolutely ridiculous. He's a con artist who's only in it for himself and the people who are going to keep him in power. That's all he's interested in. He's an extreme narcissist. And so it's all about him, him, him. And he knew that the people that would only people who would really support him are the extremist neoconservatives of the Republican Party and beyond. And so they're the ones that have that kind of reactionary, you know, antiquated viewpoint on Cuba. So what will they do? What will he do? How much can he do? Well, that will be something to be seen and something to be, you know, debated over within the United States. How will it harm Cuba? Cuba will continue to protect themselves in the same ways and defend their revolution in the same way that they have for over half a century. And the same, and they will continue to have the support of all of Latin America and most of the entire planet who have always been against the U.S. blockade against Cuba and have always supported Cuba's right to sovereignty and have recognized Cuba's extraordinary capacity of solidarity around the world, of their technological development, and of their unbelievable determination and persistence and ability to overcome the most extreme and powerful obstacles to bring forward their country, despite the immense difficulties they face. They're some of the most educated people in the world, the most politically conscious people in the world, you know, and people who strive to be a collective part of not just their own country, but of the entire planet, and see themselves in that way, despite being this tiny island of just 11 million people with basically no economy, you know, that in any way contributes to the rest of the world. They contribute in human resources, in being kind and generous citizens of the world, and Cuba will continue to do that. And I think that those of us who have, you know, supported them and will continue to, will stand up in the face of any further aggression coming from the U.S. or elsewhere against Cuba.
Eva Golinger, I want to thank you so much for making yourself available to share your unique perspective on this unique turning point in history. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Eva Golinger is an attorney and media personality and an award-winning journalist and author. She joined us from New York. Her website is evagolinger.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. Our podcasts can be found on the website globalresearch.ca. One of the understated achievements of Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution was the level of solidarity expressed for other liberation struggles, not just in Latin America, but in Africa, Asia, and even black populations within the United States. The affection for Castro was not merely inspired by its example in hiving off Cuba from U.S. imperial interests. Over the decades, Cubans have been actively involved abroad, exporting doctors, teachers, and troops, even at the cost of their own national security. To tell us more about the significance of Cuba's foreign engagements, we're joined by Abayomi Azikiwe. He's a geopolitical analyst and editor of Pan-African Newswire. Many of his essays are posted at the Global Research website. Thank you once again for joining us, Abayomi Azikiwe.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I can see where the charismatic Castro would inspire liberation struggles abroad just by the success of his liberation of Cuba from the U.S. and its local proxies. How big a factor was his solidarity actions abroad in cementing his appeal to the world's struggling peoples?
I think it was enormous. First of all, Cuba is by and large an African nation. Many of the people who reside there are of African descent. The culture is heavily dominated by African cultural retentions. They overthrew slavery. Slavery ended in Cuba much later than it ended in the United States, some two decades or more later. So they had to overcome a tremendous legacy of racism and national oppression. In regard to the 1959 revolution, it outlawed institutional racism and discrimination. This was a clear signal to the United States, where in 1959, Jim Crow was still the law of the land, not only in the South, but also many areas in the North and the West, outside of the former antebellum state. So that in and of itself was an internationalist statement being made by the Cuban Revolution towards the peoples of the world. Then, of course, if we look at the early phase of the Cuban Revolution in 1960 and 1961, we had the U.S.-backed interference in the internal independence process in the Belgian Congo. And Cuba was very much in solidarity with the Lumumba's forces. Che Guevara spoke out very strongly against the plot and also the execution of Patrice Lumumba. And then in later on in 1965, Cuba was involved in an internationalist mission in Congo that lasted for several months. Although it was not successful, it laid the groundwork for deeper involvement in other African states, particularly Angola, in 1975. But one often not recognized or known about was Cuba's involvement in defending the Algerian Revolution in 1963, when Algeria was invaded by Morocco at the aegis of the United States, and Cuba actually came to the military and political defense of the newly liberated Algerian government under Ben Bella. So these are just some of the early recollections in regard to Cuba and its internationalist impact on Africa, as well as Africans and other oppressed people throughout the world.
Now, I know that you mentioned Angola. I mean, that does strike me as being a particularly significant event, and especially when you consider the what started out in the mid 70s and then extended right through the 80s. There was eventually that battle, very decisive battle of Quito-Quanival, in which the South African apartheid forces got a major it was a major defeat, and that certainly there was a sense there of like the enormous number of Cubans who were dispatched to that involved in that effort, and it clearly did inspire the affections of well, Nelson Mandela among others. I wonder if you might just want to give us a little bit more of an understanding of that significance, not just locally, but even on an international level.
It was very important. The relationship between the Cuban government, the Cuban Communist Party, even before the Cuban Communist Party was formed in 1965, there was a close relationship between the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, the MPLA, was headed by Augustino Neto and Fidel Castro and the Cuban government, going back to the early 1960s. So in 1975, when the Angolan independence was threatened on two fronts, the FNLA, the Front, National Front for the Liberation of Angola, headed by Holden Roberto, was supported by the United States Central Intelligence Agency and the Mobutu government and the then Zaire, invaded from the north, heading towards the capital in an effort to seize control of the independence process. And you had the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, UNITA, which was based in the central and southern part of the country, close to the border with Namibia. You also had the intervention of the South African Defense Forces, and Cuba intervened in 1975, October, November, eventually sending in 55,000 troops and other personnel to defend the MPLA, consolidating their role in the independence process and beating back the South African Defense Forces, UNITA, as well as the FNLA. And that international solidarity continued for another 14 years. There were many battles that were fought over that time period. Came to a head in late 1987 and the early months of 1988, where at the small village of Quito Quanival, there was a decisive battle which convinced the South African Defense Forces that they can no longer continue to occupy Angola, and that they had to negotiate a independence process for Namibia, which was done, and an agreement was reached in 1988. The process started in 89, and Namibia held elections in November of 1989 and gained their independence on March 21st of 1990. And this, of course, also influenced the unbanning of the ANC, the African National Congress, in early February of 1990, and then Nelson Mandela in February 11th of 1990, which started the negotiation process for the transition from apartheid to the first non-racial democracy in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that there's, of course, there's been the extensive exportation of doctors and teachers around, and even engineers, to all these various different parts of the world, Haiti, and even most recently fought the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone. And so is there a way of qualifying the impact that having those medical and other social sector ambassadors going abroad has made in the world, on the world stage?
It's been a tremendous benefit to people in Venezuela, for example, and other countries in South America. Also on the African continent, they have deployed healthcare personnel in various geopolitical regions. The fight against the Ebola virus disease, Cuba played a very, very spectacular role in that entire process, to the point where even the United States, this is prior to the process of, quote, normalization, unquote, they had to recognize the contributions that Cuba made to the entire process of national liberation.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's within the Latin America, you had the with Castro, and then the rise of Chavez and Morales, and that whole sense of a regional resistance to U.S. hegemonic domination.
Yeah.
So you maybe just speak to that that catalytic role that Castro played in making all that happen. I mean, could it? Is it even conceivable that could have happened without Castro and the example and involvement that he set?
No, it could not have, or it would have been much more difficult. As early as 1959, Fidel and the Cuban revolutionaries appealed for Latin American solidarity. At that time, it was not feasible on a governmental level, although there was tremendous support on a grassroots level for the Cuban Revolution, as evidenced by the response, popular response, in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs invasion in early 1961. But since the late 1990s, with the Bolivarian Republic coming into being and Hugo Chavez becoming another major charismatic political figure throughout the region, this was accelerated with ALBA, with Mercosur, and other interstate alliances, and also in terms of getting Cuba, breaking the isolation that the U.S. imperialists had imposed on Cuba through the Organization of American States. Now there are alternative structures that are much more beneficial to the people of the region. Also, there's been an escalation in regional solidarity between South America and the African continent. You have the Africa-South America Summit, which has held four meetings. The last one, of course, was in Equatorial Guinea. Chavez was not able to attend. He sent a statement of solidarity. Prior to that, there was a meeting on Margarita Island and off the coast of Venezuela. So not only has it been a had a very positive impact on Latin American solidarity within South America and the Central America and other areas, it's also fostered international solidarity with Africa, Cuban involvement in the non-aligned movement, and other international institutions.
He spent that very special time in 1960 at the Teresa Hotel in Harlem, where he met with Malcolm X and Langston Hughes and other figures. And so he's been influential within the United States. And I'm wondering if you could trace that, you know, what that ongoing legacy, that influence for liberation struggles within the heart of the empire.
Yes, after the consolidation of the revolution in 1959, several months later, Castro visited the United States, toured, he spoke at the Harvard Law School. He wanted to have a meeting with the then president, Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower refused to speak with him, and then he met with Richard Nixon, who later wrote a memo saying that Castro was a communist and he should be overthrown. When he came back the following year in 1960, he was treated with extreme discourteousness and was literally forced out of the hotels in lower and midtown Manhattan, and wound up, as you mentioned, at the Teresa Hotel, which is still there now on 125th Street in Harlem, and was greeted there by leading figures, including Nikita Khrushchev, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, also Malcolm X, who later became El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz. And, of course, this showed that Castro had a tremendous status among people internationally as well as among African Americans in the United States.
So I'm just wondering now if you could say in maybe 30 seconds or so, what does his absence mean for the future of these liberation struggles?
Well, his legacy lives on. Cuba is there. We saw over the last few days the millions who came out to honor his legacy, and also the medical program for African-Americans, Latinos inside the United States has trained hundreds of physicians from oppressed communities here in this country. There have been at least six physicians trained from the city of Detroit in Cuba in the Latin American School of Medicine. So that is going to ensure his immortality in regard to his concrete solidarity to oppressed peoples throughout the world, even inside the imperialist countries itself.
Abayomi Azikiwe, I want to thank you very much for sharing your perspectives on this special episode of the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you for having me.
We've been joined by Abayomi Azikiwe. He is a geopolitical analyst and editor of Pan-African Newswire, and many of his essays appear regularly on the Global Research website. The collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the dissolution of the Soviet Union that followed took a huge toll on Cuba. In 1991, then Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev announced it would end its $4 to $5 billion annual subsidy to the island nation. Overnight, Cuba lost over 50% of its oil imports and 85% of its trade economy. According to an Oxfam report cited by permaculture activist Megan Quinn Bachman, buses stopped running, generators stopped producing electricity, factories became silent as graveyards. Obtaining enough food for the day became the primary activity for many, if not most, Cubans. Nevertheless, the Cuban people endured and thrived in the face of these challenges. To tell us more about how Cubans under Castro confronted the crisis, we're joined once again by Richard Heinberg. He's the author of 13 books and scores of articles on the topic of depletion and sustainability. He is senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and is regarded as one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our current reliance on fossil fuels. He joins us from his home in Santa Rosa, California. Thank you for joining us, Richard.
Yeah, good to be talking with you, Michael.
Richard, I've already outlined some of the dynamics of what Cubans were suddenly confronted with after the Soviet collapse. What were the key changes the government implemented that helped Cuba survive the storm?
Well, those changes largely had to do with the agricultural system and the transportation system, because both were heavily dependent on oil at the time of the Soviet collapse. Because Cuba had access to oil at below standard international oil prices, this was a way that the USSR was subsidizing the Cuban economy. Cuba was actually re-exporting oil, and that was its second foremost export prior to 1989. Because it was so dependent on oil for agriculture and transportation, This was a major challenge to the very existence of the country. So immediately, the fuel for tractors became scarce, fertilizers became scarce, pesticides became scarce, fuel for automobiles. There were a lot of personal automobiles at the time. But the government took steps to curtail personal automobile use and to supply more public transportation. But of course, there weren't enough buses to carry everyone, so people often had to wait hours for a bus. And over time, there had to be structural changes to the economy and to agriculture, relocalizing agriculture, because it wasn't any longer possible to move food around the country from the countryside to the cities in the quantities that had been transported. It wasn't any longer possible to operate the tractors, so those had to be replaced in many cases by animal power. Without the pesticides and herbicides, it was necessary to move to more organic forms of agriculture. And there was help for the Cuban people from outside. There were permaculturists from Australia and other countries who traveled to Cuba to teach Cuban farmers how to grow food most effectively without fossil fuel inputs. But it was a big transition, and there were prices to be paid. The average Cuban lost something like 20 pounds of body weight, and this particularly affected the very young and the very old. There was malnutrition. Almost no one actually starved to death, but it was a toll on many members of the population. On the other hand, levels of certain diseases associated with the Western industrial agricultural diet actually went into decline. Heart disease, diabetes, stroke, all of those actually. Diabetes incidence actually decreased by half, and heart disease by a third. So it was complex. You know, you can't really say it was a blessing to the country because there was a lot of suffering. But on the other hand, many of the adaptations to what became called the special period were actually beneficial, and the government was very proud of them, and many of the people actually approved of some of these measures.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about some of the challenges, though. I mean, I among the adaptive mechanisms, as it seemed a loosening of state control. You know, state-owned lands, as you say, going down to being relocalized to local farmers and cooperatives. And I think that does strike me as being kind of the opposite of what one might expect in a crisis, especially in a society that's you're portrayed as authoritarian.
Right.
I'm wondering if most other societies would have undertaken the same or similar measures, or if there was like a unique characteristic about Cuban society and the Cuban people that might have enabled these measures to go forward.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say. Cuba, in a way, is kind of a unique social experiment, it's a very authoritarian country, but at the same time, there is a great sense of mutual cooperation and even mutual sacrifice for a greater cause. So, the state-owned farms that had existed, huge state-owned farms, were broken up. They were extremely inefficient, and you could say that the breaking up of the big state farms was necessary, in fact, in order for the country and the economy to survive. Cuba had been a big exporter of sugar from sugarcane, and this was not an efficient crop to grow either from an economic standpoint or from the standpoint of nourishing the Cuban people. So very quickly, sugar cane cultivation was set aside in favor of growing fruit and vegetables. So, you know, the government, I think, had some good advice from not only from domestically from agronomists in the universities in Cuba, but also from foreigners who came to help during the special period. And I think it's to the credit of the Cuban government that this good advice was taken to heart.
Mm. Now, this is, you said that, talked about structural changes, and I thought of, you know, structural adjustment programs, and, you know, like, this is a model of agrarian reform that's quite different from what you'd expect from the IMF or the World
Right.
Bank. Do you see any evidence that the Cuban model is finding a foothold in other parts of the world?
Not so much. I mean, really, the Cuban special period was a result not just of sort of generic economic collapse, but very specifically a result of oil, petroleum, being removed from the industrial system in a very rapid, almost catastrophic way. I think part of the reason that the Cuban example is relevant is because this is something that could happen to many other countries in foreseeable ways. I mean, we have a global petroleum market that could foreseeably be disrupted profoundly as a result of war, economic circumstances, even simple depletion over time. And so in the Cuban instance, we see one example of how societies could be forced to adapt to an oil depletion or oil interruption crisis. And I think despite the fact that there was a lot of suffering in Cuba, it's in many ways a good example, an instructive example of what could be done.
Okay. Well, that certainly sounds like it has the potential to be a great Cuban export if the world is willing to listen make some sense of that surviving that that crisis. Richard Heinberg, I want to thank you very much for your time.
It's always a pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks. Richard Heinberg is senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of a number of books on fossil fuel depletion and transition, including his most recent Our Renewable Future, published in June 2016. He publishes a monthly newsletter at the website www.richardheinberg.com. Before we close this week's program, I wanted to direct listeners' attention to conversations conducted with Fidel Castro by Global Research founder and editor Michel Chalsadovsky. These talks took place in Havana during a three-day visit in October of 2010. They were transcribed, translated from Spanish, and printed in Professor Chalsadovsky's 2015 book, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. In an introduction to the conversations from November of 2010, Chalsadovsky explains that the focus of the discussion was on the dangers of a nuclear war. He states, quote, "In this broad exchange of ideas, Fidel was invariably assertive in his views, but at the same time respectful of those whom he condemned or criticized, particularly when discussing U.S. presidential politics. Fidel is acutely aware of the mechanisms of media disinformation and war propaganda and how they are used to undermine civil rights and social progress, not to mention the smear campaign directed against the Cuban Revolution." A central concept put forth by Fidel Castro in our discussions was the battle of ideas. The leader of the Cuban Revolution believes that only a far-reaching battle of ideas can change the course of world history. In addressing and understanding this worldwide crisis, commitment to the truth and analysis of the lies and fabrications which sustain the corporate and financial elites is of utmost importance, unquote. The conversations can be found by visiting the website globalresearch.ca and by clicking the feature article, Fidel Castro Ruse, His Legacy Will Live Forever, from November 26, 2016. Music this week was provided by Silvio Rodriguez and Carlos Puebla. The Global Research News Hour will be back next week. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com.